This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Saudi Arabia and their government are not great people. Now, look, the people are fine. I'm sure the people in Saudi Arabia are like people anywhere. But the government that is in place in Saudi Arabia is one of the world's most oppressive. We chronicled in the run-up to September 11th the role that members of the Saudi government, members of the Saudi royal family, may have played in the run-up to September 11th. We've seen how the Saudi government has controlled, like puppet masters, Democrat and Republican presidents to stop the truth about September 11th from getting out over the last 20 years. And then again, I was a little shocked at the attitude from a lot of the listeners, because a lot of the listeners of this station and this show, they tend to be cynical. They tend to not give anybody a break. They tend to give nobody any quarter. And yet I heard from so many people that would shrug their shoulders and say, it's Saudi Arabia. What are you going to do? It was 20 years ago. What are you going to do? I was blown away that was the response that I got from some of you. The behavior of Saudi Arabia to the United States has been absolutely outrageous. But Saudi Arabia is not alone. If you look at what Saudi Arabia has done in terms of carrying out what I consider to be terrorism in Syria, it's absolutely outrageous. The same can be said of the situation in Yemen, where they had no problem using American-made weapons to murder innocent children. And you wonder how many terrorists that creates when you see the father of a dead child, and that father of a dead child knows that the bomb that killed their son said made in the USA on it. But let's say you don't care about what the Saudi Arabia does to the United States. Let's say you don't care about what the Saudi Arabian government does in Syria. Let's say you don't even care about what they do in Yemen. Let's look at what Saudi Arabia does in Saudi Arabia. This is a country that executes people like crazy. They do it in a particularly brutal manner, generally by beheading people. They execute people for a lot of nonviolent crimes, things like sorcery. Yes, they actually execute people for sorcery. They execute people for drug offenses, nonviolent drug offenses. And try being a woman in Saudi Arabia, where they just got the right to drive a few years ago. And look, I think that's a positive development. You try to be gay in Saudi Arabia. You try to disagree with what the government says about anything in Saudi Arabia, and you see what happens to you. The Saudi government is one of the most brutal, oppressive, and least free in the world. And the one thing I didn't mention is that they were responsible for the murder of an American resident, not a citizen, but a resident, Jamal Khashoggi. And what happened when it came time to pay the piper on that? Well, some of the people involved in that murder mysteriously died, and the Khashoggi family got paid off. That's Saudi justice. What we can't make go away, it's almost like the mob. It's a Wahhabist version of the mob in its most brutal heyday. What we can't make go away with bribery and with money, we'll make go away with murder and brute force. And hey, I've been very open about my criticisms of the Saudi royal family. Perhaps one day soon I'll end up with a camel's head in my bed. Why is this coming up now? Because the fiancé of murdered journalist Jamal Khashoggi is calling on Justin Bieber to cancel his upcoming concert in Saudi Arabia next month. This singer, this Canadian singer, I don't know. I know he's very popular, but I don't really know many of his songs. I think he had one song, Boyfriend, that was popular. I don't know of his other songs, but he's a rock star. He's literally a rock star. The guy, especially among young people, he is the bee's knees. And he's among the stars set to perform at the kingdom's first Formula One Grand Prix in a town called Jeddah, which is not far at all from Mecca. And Bieber is being asked to not go. And other singers have been in the same situation. You had, I think it was Nicki Minaj, who canceled a performance there 2 years ago because of her support for women and LGBT rights. You know, I do wonder in the case of Nicki Minaj, did she not know that when she booked this show in Saudi Arabia, that it was not a place where there were a lot of women's rights and LGBT rights? It's only once she start getting called out. But here's my question for you. 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. Should Justin Bieber cancel this concert? Or is the best thing for a government like Saudi Arabia more Western influence? You know, there's a wonderful book by a gentleman who calls himself, it's a pen name, it's not a real name, Ibn Warraq. The book is called Why the West is Best. And it's all about, and this is somebody that's from the Middle East that grew up in a very strict Muslim tradition. And he's of the belief that so many of the problems in these Muslim countries can be solved by more sex, more drugs, and more rock and roll. And I'm paraphrasing here. It's a complicated book and there's a lot to it, but that is a part of it. So I do wonder if maybe having Western artists like Justin Bieber make the Saudi young women swoon just the way they do North American young women, maybe that's just the ticket. Or by doing this, does Justin Bieber continue to push Saudi Arabia more into the mainstream of the international community? Or option three, I guess, can be maybe it's none of this artist's business what Saudi Arabia does. So what do you think? Do you think he should cancel this concert next month? He is right now set to headline on December 5th. He's going to be joined by the artists David Guetta and ASAP Rocky. So it's going to be a big concert out there. Jamal Khashoggi's fiance is calling on him to back out. Human Rights Watch is calling on Bieber and the other performers to back out. They're saying that the events are aimed at diverting attention from Saudi Arabia's human rights record. What say you? 800-848-WABC. Is the right thing for him to do to cancel, to go forward with it, or do you not care? If so, I'd like to hear a reason as to why. 800-848-9222. We have a tremendous show for you today. You know, I was listening to Dominic Carter, and then I read Michael Goodwin's article in the New York Post over the weekend comparing the Rittenhouse case, which is still big. He just did this big article on a big interview on Tucker Carlson last night, comparing the Rittenhouse case to the case of Bernard Goetz. Well, you know who's going to be here in 18 minutes? Bernard Goetz. We're going to talk with him about those comparisons and get into that in a big way. 2:30, Greg Lawson, military veteran, law enforcement official, author. He is in the midst of an investigation of what happened at Roswell in 1947. So he's going to join me and give us his take. And then somebody that is always fired up, always passionate, always intelligent, even if you find yourself disagreeing with where he comes from, Jeffrey Lichtman will join me in the 3 o'clock hour. We're going to talk about this Cuomo report. We'll talk about Rittenhouse. We'll talk about Ahmaud Arbery. We'll talk about a wide variety of subjects. And if there's time, we'll get into this Middle East situation as well. 800-848-9222. See, it's funny. I've interviewed so many people, family members of 9/11 victims, academics, pundits, activists. And my question to each of them is always the same. Why is it that no matter who's president, Democrat or Republican, old, young, black, white, why is it that no matter who's president, they bend over backwards to bow and kiss the shoes of the Saudi royal family? And best I can tell, they always say the same thing. Well, initially, it was because we were dependent upon Saudi Arabia and OPEC to keep pumping that oil, and our economy is so dependent on that oil. But then that wasn't really the case up until a few years ago when we were energy independent. So then why? Then the answer comes back that we want them to buy American weapons, that it is very, very good for the American military manufacturing base for us to be able to send hundreds of millions, billions of dollars to Saudi Arabia in weapons. Then the answer always comes back as well. Well, the fact that Saudi Arabia chooses to sell oil in dollars keeps the dollar propped up on the world stage. If the Saudis were to decide that they were going to start selling their oil in yuan or some other currency, that would be absolutely devastating to the American dollar and the American currency. So let's say those three reasons are true. Then I get why the American government might be a little handcuffed and it can't call out shenanigans on Saudi Arabia. Has no problem doing it with North Korea, with Russia, with other oppressive regimes, but you can't do it with Saudi Arabia for our own reasons. Okay, I'll go along with it. I don't like it, but I'll go along with it for the purposes of this discussion. Well, why are these singers, these pop stars, David Guetta and Justin Bieber, why are they bound by that? They should take a stand, in my view, but I'd rather hear yours. 800-848-WABC. Let me begin with Ed in Babylon. Hello, Ed.
Hi, Frank. It looks like you have a good night ahead of you for us. Yeah, they should. Money is the root of all evil, right?
Well, look, it doesn't have to be, but I think it certainly can be.
Yeah, it can be. And does Justin really need money? I mean, is his career in peril? You know, what's going on here? Or is it, you know, not all for America? America first, my friend.
Right. Well, and again, even North America for the purposes of this discussion, because he is a Canadian. Yeah. But yeah, I think even if you're not American, you have to be aghast at what Saudi Arabia does to the rest of the world and to their own people. Now, one other reason that I neglected to mention for the coziness of the American government to Saudi Arabia, and maybe we'll get into this with Jeffrey Lichtman later, is Saudi Arabia's biggest enemy is Iran. So by propping up a Sunni Muslim regime in Saudi Arabia in the Middle East, it serves as sort of a counter to a Shia Muslim regime in Iran. And right now, we've made clear under multiple presidents that Iran is an enemy numero uno for us. So if Saudi Arabia is going to be an ally, then, okay, the United States government has to act like we don't see the people being beheaded for sorcery. That being said, I don't think these pop stars should be performing there and offering legitimacy to a regime that deserves no legitimacy. 800-848-WABC. You wouldn't see Justin Bieber performing in South Africa under apartheid. And I don't think you should see him performing in a country that essentially practices religious apartheid. 800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Stu in the Poconos. Hello, Stu.
Hey, Mr. Marotta. How you doing tonight?
Hanging in there, Stu. Thanks.
Well, I'm going to say happy Thanksgiving to Rita Cosby and to Dominic and you and the ABC gang in there. So I hope you have a good holiday.
Thank you. You too.
Quickly, yeah. Well, you know, I'm not big on Justin Bieber. I mean, if you said Barry White or the Beatles or somebody like that, I'd probably know a little bit more about him. But here's the thing. What do these musicians know about politics? Are they trained? Are they in our embassy? Are they really, should they really even have anything to do with our politics of our country and the world? I say no. They sing music, stick to music. It's not their job. It's not their business. And we have too many young people and other people that are being influenced by people in the music industry and athletics and stuff like that. Stick to their music and their athletical stuff. Now, I would.
Well, like, so what are you saying, Stu? What is the implication then of what you're saying? That means they should be able to perform, not be able, because they certainly are. That means they should not hesitate to perform anywhere, no matter how oppressive the country is.
Well, you know, America can be oppressive, too. I mean,
OK, whoa, Stu, really? Stu, I don't agree with everything America does, either here or abroad. There is no comparison between what the American government does and what the Saudi government does. None. There's no comparison whatsoever.
Well, I'm not saying that, but I just don't see where we should elevate musicians and athletes.
Well, that's fair. That's fair.
Do our bidding foreign. I mean, let's take an analogy. Let's say it was JFK and O'Donnell and the Bay of Pigs, and all of a sudden we decide to send the monkeys in there with the Russians to do the diplomatic understanding of that situation.
Well, so we would send the monkeys to Cuba?
Well, yes, or to Russia, because it involved both of them. And the Kennedys handled that very well, where they took the power away from the military-industrial complex, John Paul Jones and the whole deal. I mean, if you look up 13 Days movie, it lays it out very clearly as to what went on there. And thank God we didn't get into a nuclear war, because we had thinking people like JFK and O'Donnell and other people that verbally use the pen instead of the sword.
Well, look, I'm all for diplomacy. I'm all for diplomacy with everybody. And again, the big part of that Cuban Missile Crisis that we didn't learn until years later is that we were able to largely avoid nuclear catastrophe because the United States had agreed to pull nuclear weapons out of Turkey. My question is, I don't know how just Justin Bieber. Look, I respect what you're saying, that, look, these people are singers. They're not diplomats. They should be able to sing wherever they're paid to sing. I get it. In my view, I don't think it's political. I think it's an issue of human rights. I think it's an issue of giving a stamp of approval to a regime that played a role, as far as I'm concerned, in the brutal murder of thousands of Americans on September 11th. Happy Thanksgiving to you, Stu. 800-848-WABC. Justin is in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Hello, Justin.
How you doing, Frank?
I'm hanging in there, Justin.
First time caller. Thanks for putting me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, oh, well, thanks for calling.
Man. Yeah, you know, remember when you were saying, like, the sorcery of what they're doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you really look at today's American music, the mainstream that's on TV, that's all over, you know, your media and all that, there's a lot of sorcery going on with that. That's why they stood down. You know, you wouldn't get the Cro-Mags from the New York hardcore scene ever talking about something like that. You know, these kids today, they wear Cro-Mags and Misfit shirts. It's like, you know what? I saw the Misfits and the Cro-Mags at CB's on the Lower East Side when I was a kid. There was bathhouses, which were disgusting. Yeah, I mean, this is unreal, man. Give me a break. Let's get it together. You know, let's keep a positive mental attitude.
Well, fair enough, Justin. Thank you. And it must have been some days over at CBGB's, that's for sure. I will just say, though, I want to make clear that when they're executing people for sorcery in Saudi Arabia and chopping their heads off, or witchcraft, Look, we could get into a debate about whether there is such a thing as sorcery and witchcraft or not, but the preponderance of these people being killed in Saudi Arabia for witchcraft or sorcery, they're not practicing sorcery. They're not practicing witchcraft. That's an excuse that's being used to murder someone for some other reason. That's the point. They're not really sorcerers. 800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Latera in Perth Amboy. Is it Latera?
Yes, it is Latera. Yes, it is.
Latera, hello. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to make a rebuttal on the gentleman who just called in, maybe.
Sure, rebut away.
He mentioned Justin Bieber and other pop stars and singers and anyone else of a famous platform. I want to go with, I don't agree with what he said, because what he's missing is people, even young artists on those type of platforms, are detrimental when it comes to passing a message, because when it comes to getting a message across with younger people, those are who those people listen to.
Right. Well, so are you saying then that because young people would listen to Justin Bieber, for instance, that this would be something that would bring the youth cultures of Saudi Arabia and the West closer together?
Right.
Or, okay. So
what I'm saying is, being that Justin Bieber and other famous singers, rappers, and everything else, rock stars, country singers, if they decided to talk about more political things in on their platform, that reaches out to more people of all different ages, their message would be taken more serious than the news.
So are you saying then, Latera, that they should perform there or that they shouldn't?
No, what I'm saying is, when it comes to young performers, famous young people, for whatever message they want to get across to anybody, that according to their fame, using it as a platform, whether it's going to be Republican or Democrat, it will be up to them. But that gentleman who just talking about it, I just want to tell him, the platform that those famous people use will be for good cause, bad cause, being a librarian and everything else.
All right. Thank you, Latera. Appreciate it. I still don't know whether she was for Justin Bieber playing in Saudi Arabia or if she was against Justin Bieber playing in Saudi Arabia. And I honestly, I didn't want to put in the effort to find out. But I appreciate that she called. She seems like a nice lady. 800-848-9222. Nick is in Nassau County. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Frank. I think they should perform because the people, why should you punish the people? Let them enjoy themselves. You know what I'm saying? If they're so oppressed over there or whatever, just let them perform and let the people enjoy themselves.
Well, I think there's a point to be said for that, right? And we've seen in a lot of oppressive countries throughout history, we've seen a lot of American performers, whether it was Elvis, the Beatles, even Frank Sinatra, even a number of athletes, we've seen them perform in these countries. Obviously, I know it was fiction, but we remember the film Rocky IV with the hopes of winning over the hearts and minds of those people. I get that. And I think that's a legitimate point. So you say anybody that wants to perform in Saudi Arabia, they should have no qualms about getting paid millions of dollars and go ahead and performing there.
Right. It's for the people. That's all I'm saying.
All right. Well, fair enough. I get that. I get that, Nick. I don't see it the same way. I think Saudi Arabia is so horrible, meaning the government is so horrible, that they ought to be treated like a pariah by Western entertainers, at the very least. And, you know, I said the same thing with the WWE, because the WWE was looking to censor their shows that they were doing in Saudi Arabia, because they signed this big agreement with Saudi Arabia. And when you cash that check, right, from the Saudi royal family, I view it almost as blood money. It's not as it, you know, I don't know. I hear where Nick's coming from, and I was wondering if somebody would be able to persuade me. I still remain unpersuaded. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Pete is on Staten Island. Hello, Pete.
Hey, Frank. Happy Thanksgiving.
You too, pal.
You and yours.
Thank you.
Yeah, what I wanted to say, you just spoke about with the WWE. About a year ago, they had a problem, something about the getting paid, and then they held them on the tarmac hostage and everything. And then lo and behold, a year later, just about 2-3 weeks ago, where were they? Back in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah,
so,
that's exactly right. It is amazing. It is amazing what money can do. Money can buy a lot of goodwill, evidently.
Right. Well, same thing with the Jaffa suit for the 9/11 victims, which I and Renee are part of. It's like on hold. I never want to get to it. It's like they're in bed with each other. I mean, there's people waiting on it. No, they had settlements and stuff, but there are people very, very sick and that are dying that are not even going to get a chance that have been devastated, you know? And, you know, this government should realize that and, you know, take some concern to it.
Yeah. Well said, Pete. Thank you. Hey, we're going to talk with Bernard Goetz next about this this Kyle Rittenhouse situation. Those of you that are holding on this subject, though, please continue to hold. And I will try and get to your calls a little bit later. Got a lot of other stuff to get to as well. 800-848-WABC. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
You're hearing things.
You're hearing things.
On 77 WABC.
Well, this is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. A lot of folks still very interested in discussing and hearing about the Rittenhouse verdict from Friday, which wound up in an acquittal on all counts. Well, last night, Kyle Rittenhouse did his first post-trial major media interview with the Fox News Channel's Tucker Carlson. Rittenhouse described the part of the reasons that he did what he did in terms of bringing a gun to this situation in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
It was upsetting because Kenosha is my community, and I just was upset seeing my community up in flames.
Yeah, I bet you were.
Now, very interesting, the context in seeing cities, not just Kenosha, but a lot of cities around the country, up in flames with riots and things of that nature. There have been a number of comparisons. The New York Post did an article over the weekend. Dominic Carter has been mentioning this for the last week or so. There's been a number of comparisons to the Bernard Goetz case in 1984, where crime all over the city, but particularly on the subway, was out of control. And then there were four muggers shot by Bernard Goetz, somebody that was labeled a vigilante, someone who folks tried to portray as a racist. Ultimately, the jury convicted him of only an illegal gun charge, and they ruled that he had the right to use that weapon. And so I thought it might be interesting to check in with the man himself, see what he thinks the comparisons are. Bernard Goetz. Bernie, I know you don't do a lot of interviews about this subject these days. I appreciate you making a little time for us.
Okay, well, you're very welcome.
Bernie, what do you make of the comparisons between the Rittenhouse case and your own case?
Well, I think there are two main comparisons, and I don't have a lot of hope for the United States addressing it right now. The first one is you had an unethical political prosecution where you have the basically a prosecutor doing legal misconduct, misrepresenting facts to the public, and also engaging in a bad faith prosecution. That's the first comparison. And the public has been tolerating that in the United States, and that's the fundamental issue. Not like your previous WABC host was saying that, you know, Kyle should be suing this person and that person, the president, the news media. That's all well and fine. But so long as America tolerates unethical prosecution without sanctioning the prosecutors. The only time I've heard of this happening in the past 20 or 30 years has been the Duke Cross rape case, which was a prosecutor just engaging in not only a bad faith prosecution, but misleading the public. The prosecutor there got disbarred. I think he spent an hour token time in jail, too. I'm not sure about that. And then the second comparison is you have a large amount of the media is deliberately misleading the public. But again, in the United States, and by the way, I brought this up about unethical prosecutions before, and people say, well, we can't do anything because there's prosecutorial immunity. That's a generality. North Carolina, they dealt with the Duke LaCrosse prosecutor the right way. But you have Kyle Rittenhouse's attorneys were saying the prosecution was unethical. A prosecutor has an obligation to seek a good faith prosecution, to speak the truth and not to misrepresent facts. Attorneys do it, but you should not have a prosecutor deliberately doing it. And you also had Kyle himself saying, and I'm quoting him now, he said, I believe there's a lot of prosecutorial misconduct, not just in my case, but in other cases, end quote. And that's basically being ignored by the media. And I think that's a fundamental fault in the United States. It started with my case, and then it grew more and more. It was a number of years afterwards that the Republicans came back. They prosecuted Bill Clinton on they were just looking. They had a special prosecutor on him investigating everything. And finally, they got him on lying about that he denied having sex with a woman or something like that. But it was just that was a political prosecution. At least they weren't misleading the public on that too much. Let me just finish on one thing. The situation has gotten out of hand over the past several years, particularly with the leftists and the Democrats. There's been all kinds of phony prosecutions against political people they don't like, you know, Roger Stone, for example, Trump trying to get him on this, trying to get him on that. Absolutely fraudulent things. And the prosecutors just get away with it. And the FBI now, for all the misconduct the FBI has been doing the past several years with political prosecutions, seems very little is going to happen to them, and certainly nothing's going to happen to the prosecutors.
And there was an interesting article in Reason magazine last month about a Louisiana prosecutor who was found to have covered up rape allegations against a prison official. And in that case, again, there was no accountability whatsoever for government corruption. So this is a problem that's pervasive, irrespective of the politics of the prosecutor responsible for it. Do you think part of the problem in that respect, Bernie, the problem of grandstanding prosecutors seeking to bring these high-profile cases to trial, do you think part of the problem is that we have elected prosecutors in so many parts of the country, and these people view these prosecutions as a way to get votes?
Well, they use it as a way to forward their political goals. I mean, when you have prosecutors being backed by George Soros, people should be suspicious. In New York, they weren't my prosecution. It wasn't backed by Soros. You had a corrupt political establishment here in New York just trying to save face. My case basically derailed at the time we had Mario Cuomo was governor, and the Democrats were thinking of him as their main presidential candidate. And my case derailed Cuomo's presidential ambitions.
In your case,
that wasn't reported in the media here. For example, Cuomo, 6 months after my case, he went to California to test the presidential waters, and he gave speeches in front of thousands of people in both Los Angeles and then San Francisco. And in San Francisco, he talked about how New York has successful social programs for dealing with poverty, and, you know, New York was a role model for the rest of the country. And the audience was openly laughing at him in Los Angeles. You never heard about that in the media here. Then the next day, he went up to San Francisco, the liberal San Francisco, and he gave the same speech. And they said after, they didn't laugh at him, but they said after his speech, you could hear a pin drop. There was no applause. And, you know, it's basically unethical prosecutions should, when you have a prosecutor acting in bad faith, that simply should not be tolerated in the legal system. Now, there is a need for general prosecutorial immunity, but this is getting ridiculous.
Federal Judge Frederick Block has actually written a column. It's a few years old now, but I think it's just as relevant. I'm going to link to it on my Facebook page if people want to read it at facebook.com/MoranoFan. He believes that we should put an end to prosecutorial immunity for some of the same reasons that you talk about, because these prosecutors really shouldn't be above the law. So it's an interesting thing that a federal judge, a sitting federal judge, is saying that that same thing.
I didn't hear that, but that's wonderful to hear.
I'm going
to
send.
I don't have much hope for improvement.
But. I'm going to send you this article. One comparison that's been made in your case and in the Kyle Rittenhouse case was, even though that neither of you were could credibly be called white supremacists, you had a lot of people seeking to make both of your cases a racial issue. In your case, you had folks like Al Sharpton out there, sort of trying to fan the flames of racial hyperbole.
Well, by the way, just let me just mention a cute little tidbit here. My case started Al Sharpton. It put him on the map. When the media, the dishonest media and political establishment, was looking for a black spokesman at that time, at the time of my incident, when the media actually had a policy, media here in the city, of not covering Al Sharpton because he was considered a fraud. Roy Innes, when I talked to him, he said he tried initially, he reached out to Al Sharpton before my case on some political things, and he said, well, he was going to, they agreed to work, Roy agreed to work with him on one project, I forget what it was, and Roy said he would bring 20 people, and Al said, told Roy, I will bring 20 people too. Roy, when they went to the incident, Roy was there with his 20 people. Al Sharpton came alone. He had nobody with him. And Al Sharpton was a nobody. But they wanted a spokesman. They got it in Al Sharpton. I found out about him. The first time I found out about him, I walked back into my apartment building. I'd been out shopping for about 15 minutes or half an hour. Must have been half an hour. And I came back, and the doorman said, by the way, these are for you. And he handed me 100 white envelopes, all similar. He said, someone left them off for here for you. And I said, what is this about? And he said, well, there was a demonstration in front of the building. It was very funny. It was this guy, people were marching around in a circle in front of the front of the building carrying signs. The media came, took some pictures, and they were filming them. And then the media left. And as soon as the media left, all the people left. And he said they were here for a total of maybe 5 minutes. So anyway, the next day, it was in the papers about demonstrations in front of my house accusing me of racism. And by the way, of the 100 envelopes, 40 of them were empty. of the 60 other ones, it's about 55 of them were all written by the same person. It was just Al Sharpton held up, these are a bunch of letters from people who are, you know, protesting Bernie Goetz, and, you know, it was all baloney.
Well,
but anyway, I diverged.
On the subject of race, do you think that part of the reason both your case and the Rittenhouse case became racial flashpoints is maybe because there were careers to be made by fanning the flames of racial disharmony with Sharpton back then?
Yes, but there's two main reasons why race is used in cases like this. One reason is if you have nothing else, you cry racism. And then the other reason, unfortunately, a standard tactic of the political left has been since the Communist Party started, is to divide people. They fan the flames of racial resentment as much as they can, and if people believe the media, and many people are in touch with limited or have a certain amount of limited media in their life, if they believe it, they say the cases are racial. And it's just, it's bad faith. There's a lot of dishonesty in America. And that's what Dr. Kevorkian said before he died, when he talked about, they asked him, what do you think the biggest problem in America is? And he says it's dishonesty. There's too much lying going around.
And it sounds like you're not at all optimistic that that'll change anytime soon.
Well, if the prosecutors are able to just get away with it, and I think in general prosecutorial immunity is a good thing, because you need, you know, you can't have any time someone is prosecuted, they turn around and they say, well, I'm being discriminated against. But that when there are cases openly of the prosecutor acting in bad faith, like in my case, there was numerous incidences where he was misleading the public deliberately, just, you know, smear campaigns. Same thing in the Rittenhouse prosecution. Same thing in the political prosecution against Donald Trump and Trump supporters since he was elected. People aren't even talking about it in the media being an issue now, even though you did have Rittenhouse himself brought this up, and he made some statements about it 2 days ago, and so did his attorney. But people are not focusing on that, and you know, when they say, well, we have a dishonest media, and Rittenhouse should be suing the media, that doesn't address the fundamental problem, because when a person in a political case, if you're being prosecuted, that shuts you down. You can't defend yourself. You can't really present your political case well if you're being prosecuted, if you want to have the media act better, prosecute or sanction the attorney who did the Rittenhouse prosecution, mm-hmm. and let the media cover that story. See if they do.
Bernie, very quickly, I want to pick your brain on one or two other issues, because it's been a while since we spoke. You ran for mayor 20 years ago. You were one of the first major figures in New York to call for decriminalization of marijuana. Now it looks like New York has sort of caught up with you, and that New York and New Jersey are moving ultimately towards decriminalization. How are you feeling about America's marijuana policy? Do you feel like we're moving in the right direction?
I don't know. You might as well decriminalize marijuana and probably other drugs too. But it's not going to solve America's problems. It would make things. Why make problems for people if they smoke marijuana? Why make problems for people if they take drugs? That's my own feeling. And it also causes a lot of police abuse and stuff. You know, you have police you have these cases where they break down the door of somebody and because they think they were involved in a drug deal and this and that. You take the money out of drugs by decriminalizing them. But, you know, the marijuana is a positive step.
You were also one of the biggest promoters of vegetarianism when you ran for mayor, when you ran for public advocate. Now, the incoming mayor of New York City is a vegetarian, mostly for health reasons, not necessarily for animal rights reasons. But are you at all optimistic that we could see some of the aspects of your platform that dealt with promoting vegetarianism enacted in an Adams administration?
Well, I don't know what to make of Adams. His going in to the election, I was under the impression that he was the handpicked candidate of de Blasio, and that he's, you know, that he's in with that whole clique, and that he was involved with a lot of the crap that goes on in New York, something about homeless shelters and stuff and people getting money and stuff like that. But he's talking a different line now. Let's see. It's something people don't talk about too much right now, but I think vegetarianism is a fundamental factor in advancing civilization, that there's one species on the planet that controls everything, and our species, I think, has to or should mature and grow. It may not, but for billions of years, it's been one big restaurant out there. All the animals eating other animals, and people talk about, well, nature would be. Might be better off without mankind, but nature itself tends to be a bit of a nightmare, and you just don't see it as much when there's not the density of animals.
I will point out that your old website from 16 years ago is still up. If people want to look at your platform and some of the other ideas on political reform and some other things that were very progressive and very forward-thinking at the time, they could go to BernieForMayor.com. Bernie, it is always a great opportunity to speak with you. I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, well, yes. But by the way, I feel America is making a lot of mistakes. New York's making a lot of mistakes. What just happened in this last voting, I just want to bring up a few things. People were saying about many of the New York Republicans voted for this, one of the big funding
right,
bills.
Infrastructure,
because infrastructure, because basically it bails out New York City. What it does, it promotes socialism. And it's bad for America. But one of the main things that the Democrats wanted was to bail out New York City, bail out California, and indirectly bail out Illinois. And so they got it in that bill. So it's what's going in America. There's just too much deceit and America. I just hope that America will become a more honest country. And
Bernie,
what's going to be will be.
I have to run. I appreciate you taking the time. You're welcome here anytime. And I appreciate you. I appreciate the conversation.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Frank.
Thank
Good
you.
Night.
Bernard Goetz, if you want to comment on any portion of our conversation, you can give us a call, 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. One of the things Bernie always told me is that by staying away from animal products, meat, cheese, and so forth, even fish, that would be a great way to control my weight. Well, if you're not willing to go that far, but you still want to lose weight, then something that you can think about is the Skinny Center. Mitch Suss and the good folks over at the Skinny Center reached out to me when I was talking about my efforts to try and lose a few pounds because he's got this great medical weight loss center in Westchester. It's called the Skinny Center, and they've done an incredible job with my colleague, Greg Kelly, who looks great. So this program is terrific from what I could see with Greg. It's genuine. And I am looking forward to going through their exclusive lab testing. But this week's Thanksgiving, that's going to be tough. So that is, he sent me this product called Skinny Spritz, which is sort of an appetite suppressant and will keep me from gaining another 10 pounds over the Thanksgiving holiday. I've been pretty pleased with this product already, and this is a great way to jumpstart your weight loss program. So call the Skinny Center at 914-703-4811 if you're interested in this. That's 914-703-4811 or go to theskinnycenter.com. That's theskinnycenter.com.
77 WABC, where the action is.
We are New York on New York's Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Blondie, I am a big Blondie fan. Always have been. You know, so it's an interesting thing. Years ago, my friend Vinny would always joke around that his wife didn't like me, right? This is 17, 18 years ago. So what he would do is he'd throw me under the bus with her with everything. So if he was out late for a work function or he was out late getting drunk or having dinner, whatever the case may be, even if he wasn't with me, he would always tell his wife he was out with Frank. So I said, Vinny, why are you doing that? And he would always say to me, well, she can't stand you anyway. So I figure, why should I get one of my other friends in trouble if she already dislikes you? And I really couldn't argue with that. So then a few years later, this is about 2012 or so, my good friend Mike Wolf, who's a regular listener to the show, he might be listening now. Hi, Mike, if you're listening. He introduces me to his fiance, Lisa. Great lady, nice woman. I went to the wedding. Now, when he introduced me to Lisa, I had not seen Mike in at least 6 or 7 months, at least. You know, he and I were tight when we were younger, and then, you know, you go in separate professional tracks, and you see one another less and less. And so I meet Lisa, and he said, oh, it's the infamous Frank Morano. It's great to meet the person Michael is always spending his nights with. And I'm thinking to myself, what? I haven't seen him in 6 months. He is throwing me under the bus when I haven't seen him with his fiancée. So I played along. I was a good sport. I filed that in the back of my brain. Okay. So then Sunday comes around. I'm tired. I have to prepare for the show. I'm putting up Christmas decorations and so forth all day. And I get the call from my friend, my councilman, the minority leader of the city council, Joe Borelli, who says, hey, you know, do you want to smoke a cigar with me while I put up Christmas decorations? And I really didn't. I really wanted to stay home, rest, work on the show, and prepare for yesterday's show. So I said, you know, Rachel's kind of, she's kind of cranky. She's 9 months into her pregnancy. She's given me all these things to do. So we hang up. And Rachel says to me, why are you making me and what I heard her say was, why are you making me an scapegoat for your, for your not wanting to do things? And I said, I got to write that down. She sees me writing this down feverishly. She said, what are you writing down? I said, I'm writing down the words scapegoat. And she said, I didn't say scapegoat like an escape artist. I said, scapegoat. So I heard scapegoat. And now I want to actually meet an scapegoat. I want a pet scapegoat. I want to write a children's book about an scapegoat. But lo and behold, sometimes you need a scapegoat. Other times you need an escape goat.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Everyone, this is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. It is interesting, since I was a child, many of the people that I have tended to be friends with, many of the people that I have gravitated towards socially, with even in within my own family, within the workplace, within academia, have tended to be older. Most of my friends have tended to be older. And sometimes slightly older, 5, 10, 15 years, sometimes significantly older, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, not unusual. And it's been sort of a mixed blessing. On the one hand, I really do feel as if I've been able to benefit from the collective wisdom of generations that that existed before me, that had I not had so many friends and associates that were in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, that I would not have been able to have that same experience. But on the other hand, it is sort of sad, because you get to a point where, and I'm still at this point, but when you have so many friends and associates that are older, you end up going to a lot of wakes and funerals, and you end up losing a lot of people that you really care about. Whereas a lot of people that tend to remain friends with strictly folks that are their own age or folks that are younger, they don't have that sort of same problem. Now, the reason I mention that is because I don't know if this has colored my bias, but I have long been irked by America's obsession with youth culture. We've got to put on television shows. We've got to put on radio shows that appeal to the youth, that appeal to people between the age of 25 to 54. Well, what about this particular TV show, which is really interesting, but which has a somewhat older audience? Oh, no. Advertisers don't want to reach the older audiences because their consumer habits are already formed. And we need to reach the young people. That's who advertisers want to reach, because their consumer habits are still malleable. I always thought that was nonsense, because I'd point out, well, hey, look, have you seen the young people of today, 20, 25, 30 years old? None of them have any money. The only people that have any money are people 65 and 70. So in addition to that, one of the things that kills me is I have seen time and again in stores, in the workplace, in restaurants, in the nonprofit sector, in all sorts of spheres of life, people who are older be treated almost as if they're less than a human being. And instead of having understanding and empathy and reverence for Americans who are seasoned citizens, I've seen institution after institution, whether it's the media, whether it's politics, whether it's commerce, whether it's academia, treat these people as if they're to be shunned, to be shown the door. And that's why in 2020, when so many of the leading presidential candidates were people in their 70s, Donald Trump, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, I thought, okay, whoever gets elected is going to be the oldest president ever. Maybe this will show America that you can be a seasoned citizen and still have a lot to offer. So now whoever won in 2020, whether it was Donald Trump or Joe Biden, was going to be the oldest president in history. Turned out Biden won. On Saturday, Biden became, he turned 79 years old, far and away the oldest president we've ever had. If Donald Trump runs for president again in 2024 and he gets elected, he'll be 78 at the time that he's elected. And if he serves a full 4 years, he'll be as old as Joe Biden is and will be when Biden finishes his term. So my question for you is this. Here in New York, we have a mandatory retirement age for judges of 70 years old. And you can get 3 2-year extensions if you're a state Supreme Court justice and you're appointed by the governor. So you could technically serve till 76, but you can't serve beyond 76. My question for you is whether you forget putting aside the personalities. Because I know there's a lot of people that don't like Joe Biden. There's a lot of people that don't like Donald Trump. A lot of people that don't like Bernie Sanders. A lot of people that may not like Elizabeth Warren or Hillary Clinton. Putting aside the personalities, do you believe that there should be an age limit on the presidency? Joe Biden just turned 79. Is 79 too old to be president? Irrespective of what you think of the individuals who've held the office, being president is a very demanding job. It's a physically demanding job. It's a mentally very taxing job. Is it time? We have a minimum age. We have a minimum age of 35. Should we have a maximum age, as we do for New York State Supreme Court justices and New Jersey judges as well? I don't know the answer to it. My view was always no, but I'll tell you, I do see President Biden, and I did notice with President Trump to some extent that these gentlemen have lost a step or two off their fastball. And I know Joe Biden just had his physical and he published the results. There was one of the things that was very telling to me. They released detailed physical notes, and it talked about the problems that he has with his voice and how he gets into these coughing fits. And they talked about his spinal arthritis, and they talked about his physical health. And basically, they said he's in pretty good shape for a 79-year-old man. But what was not released was there was no mention of any cognitive test. And so I'm wondering, one, should there be a maximum age to be president? Two, what age is too old to be president? And again, if you don't like Joe Biden, pretend it is a president you do like. If you don't like Donald Trump, pretend it is a president you do like. And three, should a president, as part of their physical, be taking a cognitive test? And should those results be reported to the public? 800-848-WABC. If you want to weigh in on any of those, that's 1-800-848-9222. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we're going to talk with Greg Lawson. Greg Lawson is a fascinating guy, military veteran, veteran law enforcement officer, and author of a new book called Roswell, The After Action Report. Jeffrey Lichtman will be here in the 3 o'clock hour. We'll go through your mail a little bit later as well. 800-848-9222. Mary Beth is on Long Island. Hello, Mary Beth.
Good morning, Frank. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you.
In regards to the age limits for candidates, I look at the difference between the vigor and I think the mental clarity of Trump versus Biden. I don't think that there should be an age limit on who can run, but I definitely think these people's faculties need to be tested before they can run.
Well, so should every candidate, irrespective of age, have to deal with a cognitive test, or should it only be candidates over a certain age?
Well, first of all, I think just listening to them and hearing them speak and hearing them answer questions on their own shows that they do have the ability to think on their feet. But I don't know if a number, an age is appropriate, but I don't know. That's an interesting question, Frank. But I think if someone is 80 years old and running for the presidency, yeah, their faculties need to be tested.
Well, like, for instance, we've had senators in their 90s, and you have Chuck Grassley, who's in his late 80s. He's running for another 6-year term. And you wonder, can a 90-year-old really grasp the intricacies of laws involving Facebook as well as, say, a 45-year-old? Maybe they can. Maybe that's a little bit of age discrimination on my part. Or should there be some sort of an age limit?
Well, I think there should be term limits.
Oh, well, I'm with you on that.
In there for 40, 50 years.
I am with you on that. I've always said that. I completely agree with you on that.
Yeah, but I mean, look at Joe Biden. Let's be honest. I think that he needs to be tested, and I think the results need to be shown to the public. I really do.
Well, again, if it happens for Biden, it's got to happen for Trump or anybody else. You know, again, I didn't want to make this a Biden or a Trump thing because those are the two least popular presidents of all time at this point in their presidency. But let's pretend it's a president you love. Whoever that president is, how old is too old? Should there be a maximum age? And should presidents over a certain age have to take a cognitive test, the results of which are left to the public? Now, that might seem like an obvious answer, but maybe it's not. Because let's say you have a world leader that is... remember, and I know Smirkanish mentioned this on his show on Saturday, that there were books written by psychologists showing how mentally unstable Trump was and how he was hurtling towards dementia becoming unhinged. I don't think they used the word dementia during the impeachment trial. You're always going to have people that claim the person that they don't like is mentally diminished. It's clear to me that both Trump and Biden have lost a step or two off their fastball. If you look at the kind of interviews that they were doing 20 years ago, they look like different guys. But, I mean, I understand it. You're a lot different at 59 years old than you are at 79. You're a lot different at 55 years old than you are at 75 years old. So I'm just wondering if there should be some sort of a policy. But if we did have a president, let's say it was the current president, if we did have a president that was shown to be of diminished capacity and that was made public, does that send a message to potential adversarial world leaders like Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, you name it, that we're in a better position to be taken advantage of? Maybe it shouldn't be made public. So our adversaries don't know that our president could be of diminished capacity. I want to try and get a consensus on an objective criteria here. I don't want this to become, Joe Biden is an old and frail rant session. I don't want this to become, Donald Trump is old and frail rant session. I want a uniform policy that Democrats, Republicans, and independents can get behind. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Tony is in Florida. Hello, Tony.
Hi, how are you doing this evening?
I'm well. Thanks, Tony.
Well, you know, I remember when Reagan was running for office and the press was talking about, you know, he was too old and he might die while he was in office. And I was 20. And at the time I thought, you know, I always thought the older the person was, the wiser they were, and that we should have presidents that were older. And this is back when I was 20, and I'm 62 now, and I still feel the same way. Mm. I think that the older a person is, the wiser they are, And I don't think they should have to go through any kind of tests unless there's a reason, like with Biden. But somebody like Trump, I mean, he's great, and he doesn't appear to have any problems.
There you go. So no cognitive test in Tony's playbook. Okay. 800-848-WABC. So there were reports that, and O'Reilly writes about this in his book, that after Reagan's shooting, there were times when Reagan demonstrated a diminished mental capacity. And they believe, and O'Reilly writes about this in his book, Killing Reagan, that this could have been a result of the very early result of Alzheimer's presenting itself. Now, that's not likely to happen with a president that's 55. It is more likely to happen with a president that's 71, 72. Certainly 75, you know, Trump will be 78 if he's elected in 2024. Biden will be 82 if he's elected in 2024. 800-848-WABC. Should there be, there's a minimum age for president. Should there be a maximum age? 800-848-WABC. Joe is in Manhattan. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Frank. My point of view is as follows. And I need just about a minute or so to express my views. As far as the presidential elections every 4 years, in my view, that's an error historically. It should be every 3 years, so that if a president is going berserk, at least that would save us from 25% of the damages he or she could be committing. And then the total terms would be three, whereby in totality 9 years consecutively or inconsecutively. Also, as far as dementia, et cetera, if a president is not able to rule due to mental incapacity, the Senate would then make the determination by a vote of 67%, and only that party's pick would become president, including possibly the vice president.
Well, that, Joe, precisely the rationale behind the 25th Amendment, which does have a provision for the cabinet and the Congress to remove a president for incapacitation. They wanted to avoid a repeat of what happened with Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson had a stroke and was largely incapacitated, and no one really knows who was running the country at the time. A lot of people believe it was his wife, Edith, that was running the country at the time. Let me squeeze in one more call here, and then we're going to get to Greg Lawson. Patrick is in Ohio. Hello, Patrick.
Hi, Frank. Good morning.
Morning.
Hey, you know, I think the notion of cognitive testing for presidential candidates should occur, but I believe it should happen before an election cycle begins, because if they don't have it before the election, the guy could be turned out like a guy like Biden or a fellow like Trump, you know?
So would you make it every candidate has to take a cognitive test or only candidates over a certain age?
I would say all candidates.
All candidates.
Just to be fair.
Yeah. Well, look, I don't know that I have a problem with that, Patrick. I think as long as you have a cognitive test that is fairly administered, I think that's fine. I mean, the problem is when these presidential candidates are doing their own testing with doctors, like the doctor that released the statement about Trump in 2016, who put out that statement that I can state unequivocally that if Donald Trump's elected, he'll be the healthiest president ever elected. He then 2 years later admitted that Donald Trump drafted that statement for him. So what are you really gaining if the presidential candidates are themselves releasing these statements? If it's an objective physician that can do a basic cognitive test, I think that's one thing. But we'll try and get to more of your calls on this subject a little bit later. We got Greg Lawson coming up. People love logging on to their bank accounts to see their balances and their portfolio grow. Saving money can be difficult, and it's gratifying to see our balances increase. But what most Americans are not seeing is the hidden enemy that's slowly stealing their money right in front of their very eyes, and that's inflation. Inflation is decreasing the value of your portfolio even while it's growing in number. As inflation increases, so do the costs of goods. Your dollar has less buying power and is worth less than it was the month before. What can you do about it? Gold and silver. Gold, silver, and precious metals are hedges against inflation. As inflation increases, gold becomes more valuable. Doesn't matter how diversified you are, if you're in traditional investments, all your wealth is essentially tied to the same system. That's where legacy precious metals comes in. If you have an existing retirement account, think about rolling it into a gold or a silver IRA. And if you do it with Legacy Precious Metals. Legacy is the company that you can trust because they give you unbiased information based on your individual situation. Contact Legacy Precious Metals today. Call 866-932-0635. That's 866-932-0635. Or you can visit LegacyPMInvestments.com. If you go to LegacyPMInvestments.com and you request the information for free, when they ask you where you heard about it, be sure to tell them from me, Frank Moreno.
The Other Side of Midnight presents The Midnight Files.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride, filled with a longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it till tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you? Midnight in the desert.
This is The Other Side of Midnight on 77 WABC. I'm Frank Moreno. Thanks for listening. I have really been interested in UFO issues, and if you've listened to this show, you know that we've covered a lot of issues related to UFOs, extraterrestrials, and in general, exploring the unexplained. Well, there is a new book out that takes a law enforcement tactician's approach to investigating what happened in Roswell, New Mexico, back in 1947. The book is called Roswell, The After Action Report, and its author is not your typical UFO kind of guy. He's a very seasoned military veteran, law enforcement official, and a guy who's got a master's degree. His investigator chops are just impeccable. Very, very pleased to be joined by Greg Lawson, veteran law enforcement officer, military veteran, paranormal explorer, and author whose latest book is indeed Roswell, The After Action Report. Greg, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thanks for asking me.
So you have, as I mentioned, a very interesting background. You are not the typical profile for somebody that investigates ghosts and aliens. You spent 10 years in the military, in the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. Boy, you must be a real slacker not making it to the Marines or the Coast Guard. You've got a master's degree in education. You have a lot of experience in law enforcement. You've been a professional investigator, a police academy instructor. You are John Q. establishment. You are out of central casting for Johnny Law. How does somebody go from that kind of a background to discovering paranormal human experiences and investigating physical anomalies?
I think I came full circle. I wasn't supposed to do all this stuff. People ask me all the time, like Army, Navy, and Air Force. They're like, what? I'm like, yeah, the Armed Forces Attention Deficit Disorder. So I kind of started off in the paranormal, and then you know, as a kid, I was like 5 years old. My brother was 12 years older than me, so he was 17 at the time, and he would put me on his Triumph Bonneville 650. He'd set me on the tank, you know, with no helmet or anything, and we'd go riding around on his motorcycle and look for graveyards and abandoned buildings and stuff like that. And he would take me with him. And I'm not really sure why he did that, other than he wanted to scare the bejesus out of me. And so we would do that. And, you know, we'd go to a graveyard, and he'd go find the youngest child buried in the graveyard and make up some story about, you know, him and how that's going to affect me somehow, you know. And so I would do that to my friends, of course, in elementary, junior high, and high school. And I kind of hung out with all the people that rode around fast cars, drank beer. Back then, it was legal to drink beer in Texas at 18 years old. Mm. And so we kind of did all that stuff. And the economy crashed in 1980-81. All the money went away. All the jobs went away. I had no experience, no training or anything. So I ended up going in the military. And the rest is history after that.
They can check out your website, theparanormaldetective.com. There's some great stuff on there. Video commentaries, podcasts, all sorts of great investigations you've done. In fact, we could have you back every week just profiling a different one of these cases that you've looked into. But you've spent a lot of time investigating cases involving the paranormal, the unexplained. When you get the call, you're almost in some ways like a real life Ghostbuster. When you get the call, what percentage of these cases would you say are real? And what percentage would you say are explainable by some other means?
Probably 2%, maybe. Most of the stuff that people experience, you can kind of explain it away. And don't get me wrong. People, you know, say, well, you're a debunker. You're a skeptic. Well, for one, I'm not a debunker. If it's not paranormal, it's not paranormal. I can't make it paranormal.
Sure.
And I am a skeptic, and you have to be a skeptic. If you're a true investigator, you have to be a skeptic, because there's only a lot, you know, like there's a continuum, right? There's a continuum of gullible to cynic. There's that line from that point to that point. And skeptic floats around in the middle someplace based on the experience, training, and evidence this person gathers up. So, you know, a lot of this stuff is very explainable. But, you know, I've talked to a lot of ghost hunters, and I've talked with a lot of paranormal investigators that are, you know, they kind of roll their eyes at me because, you know, I can't say that I have 750 investigations. Yeah, I've been investigating this for 30 years, and I have 750 investigations. Well, my investigation might take a year long. I don't go to a location, set up my cameras, sit there and listen and talk to the dark for 4 hours and leave. That's not what I do. And the people that I work with are people that don't want to be on TV. They don't want to be outed as a kook or something. Some of them are prominent business owners, faculty, you know. So there's a level of, I don't want to say secrecy, but there has to be a level of trust there that I'm not going to just go and, you know, tell their story unless they let me tell their story. So it's a different kind of investigation.
Can you give us an example of one or two paranormal human experiences that you've investigated and you were unable to find another explanation for?
Yes. So I was approached by a ghost hunting group out of Austin, and I've talked to this guy many times, and he was kind of giving me the rundown. And it's funny about a lot of ghost hunting groups, they don't share their information with other people. They try to be all things to all people. In other words, they don't invite, you know, specialists in to help them investigate. They just kind of work through whatever it is. So the really solid groups will reach out to professionals and go, hey, this is what I'm working on. Can you explain this to me? So this particular guy talks, we talk quite a bit. And he said, look, this is what I got. I got a family that has a little girl. They live in this house. The house isn't that old. It's maybe about, 10 years old. And they say that their little girl is talking to someone. They say that they hear the little girl laughing and giggling, and they think they hear somebody else that's giggling, and they're not sure. It's like a different voice. And at night, certain things move, toys move and stuff at night. And, that's all real explainable, usually, because the child gets up at night and goes and gets its teddy bear and moves it someplace else or something like that, right? Well, they set up the cameras, and they actually did a pretty good investigation. They did it over several days, and none of this was really explainable. They didn't catch anything. They caught a toy moving. It didn't move very far, but it did move. They caught a stuffed animal leaning over, but nothing real telling. And so they said, I wanted to check the background of all this. Well, that's where the rabbit hole comes. When you start looking at the background, you go, okay, this house, how old is it? This particular house was like, it was nearly 10 years old. And they look at it, and two families had lived in it. I said, well, let me do some other research on it and find out what kind of involvement we have with law enforcement, fire, EMS, anything like that, and OSHA and that sort of stuff to see if there was anybody killed while the house is being built or whatever. So you go through all the contemporary stuff and you go, I don't have anything. I have nothing. Nothing exceptional happened here. Well, the ghost hunters will then roll over and say, well, it must have been an Indian that lived here, was buried here, or a caveman or whatever, whatever they're going to use their inductive reasoning to explain the situation. I try not to go there. If I can't prove it, I just shrug my shoulders and go, I don't know what's going on.
Well, what advice? Case, yeah, please. No, I please continue.
I'm sorry it's long, but this particular case, what ended up happening, he goes, well, I'm going to tell him I can't figure anything out. I said, no, let me think about this for a little bit. So I thought about it for a little bit. I thought, let's take a look at the family that lived here before. They had moved to Houston. So I did some research on that. And there was a reason they moved to Houston. Their little girl had cancer. And when they got to Houston, they lived there a couple of years, and she died. So my explanation is she's returning to the place that she was happiest. That's the only thing I got. And I don't have any, other than that, it's just some anomalous activity that's happening in their house.
If someone experiences something like that, what advice would you have for them? Let's say they don't have access to you, or you're not available because you're investigating 750 other cases. What advice do you have for people that have experienced or believe they're currently experiencing something that is, in fact, paranormal?
The first thing you have to be is an adult. Take a deep breath and get yourself checked out. Let's make sure that you're not having some sort of other mental health issues. Make sure that you don't have, any, if you're taking some sort of a couple of different drugs, whether they're acting weird with each other, in combination, it might be causing some perception issues, some cognitive issues, those sort of things. You gotta get rid of all that first. And the funny thing is, when you're doing these investigations, sometimes people aren't truthful with you because they don't want to tell you that they're on drugs or that they normally do recreational drugs or something like that. And like I said, this is based on trust. You got to tell me everything here. I'm not saying that, ghost stuff can't happen to you when you've smoked weed. I'm not saying that's happening. I mean, that doesn't happen. I'm just saying that is another thing that we need to take a look at. Do you have... when you're asking people, you have to be very careful because a lot of people are very guarded about their information. So that's the first thing you have to do. After that, then you compartmentalize everything that's happening. Try to isolate if there's actual physical anomalies that are happening. and see if you can somehow capture it. That's the funny thing about a lot of the modern ghost hunters. Like I said, I've been doing this since I was a kid. You know, it was mainly urban exploration stuff. And then I started getting into the whole, you know, Ouija board and you know, just all kinds of metaphysical stuff. And I didn't realize it was really a thing. You know, it was there were movies on TV, but I just wasn't watching all the contemporary TV shows that are coming out now. But that's something that you have to look at is, you know, what is this person's experience and how do we separate that? Go ahead.
No, it makes sense. You are now with this latest book, Roswell, The After Action Report, exploring something that a lot of people have looked at for decades. How do you make the leap from investigating ghosts and things of that nature to then investigating this Roswell crash back in 1947? Is it sort of just a natural extension of wanting to find explanations for unexplained things, or was there something more here? Why did you choose to pivot towards Roswell?
Well, there's a couple of different things. So in any investigation, whether it's insurance fraud or it's a murder or it's a cold case or whatever, there are specific steps that you need to cover, specific things you need to do, specific ways you need to do it in order to glean as much information out of the people that you're talking to, collect as much evidence as you possibly can, and interpret that evidence properly. So it's kind of a natural thing, whether I'm doing a legitimate criminal investigation or I'm doing something else, I still bring that with me. And the biggest thing on that is how you interview people, because if you're not trained on how to interview people, and I'm not talking about the basic who, what, when, where, why, and how, I'm talking about cognitive interview, regressive interviews, and a whole host of other types of things that you have to deal with when interviewing people. I just naturally go into that. As far as Roswell goes, my wife and I have been going up to Roswell for about the last 15 years. I think we've attended, I don't know, 10 or 11 of the UFO conferences on the 4th of July weekend. She goes shopping with her friends, and I go and attend all the alien abduction seminar, you know, military mind control seminars, and do all that stuff. And I've got to know a lot of the regular presenters there, and I got to talk to Jesse Marcel Jr. multiple times, and I've talked to a lot of the other main investigators, and to be quite honest with you, I'm standing on these guys' shoulders. These guys already did all the work, some of the work better than others. And so what I did was, you know, I've had people interview me on this book, and they're like, "Oh my God, man, are you kidding me? Another Roswell book? Are you crazy?"
That's precisely what I was going to ask you. Now, I haven't read your book yet. I'm looking forward to reading it, but I have interviewed Jesse Marcel Jr. I've interviewed probably 24 authors all dealing with this subject of this Roswell, New Mexico crash in 1947. What's new about your book? What's different about your book than these dozens, hundreds, thousands, maybe even, books that have been written on the subject?
Well, the good thing is several people that have interviewed me have gone back and read the book and actually responded like,
which,
wow,
I will do, I, by the way. I want to be very clear. I will do that.
Well, I mean, everybody has, you know, we have priorities, right? And there's a finite amount of time. So, but in these, you know, I've got some really good feedback going. I didn't know what to expect when I got into this thing, and now I see what you were doing. So what I did was, is I boiled it down. I got rid of all of this clutter, all of this extra stuff that happened after 1978. After 1978, Stanton Friedman interviews Jesse Marcel. It blows up from there. It's, it, you know, everybody's talking about it. They're doing stuff. And then the Unsolved Mysteries episode comes out in the late 80s. And all of a sudden, you know, hundreds of people come forward going, "Hey, I know all about this." Well, they didn't know all about it. They said that they saw certain things that in their mind were related to this and talked to different people and stuff like that. I took out all that. When you walk into it, when I walk into a cafe in some town and say, hey, my name is Greg Lawson. You can go to my website, theparanormaldetective.com. I consult on some TV shows. I write some books, and I'm writing some stories about the guy that hung himself on the bridge over there. Anybody know anything about that? Guess how many hands go up? A whole bunch. Mm. Everybody wants to, you know, say whether they want it or not. We had a case here in Austin called the Yogurt Shop Murders. Four teenage girls were murdered, and then they burned down the building that they were in, and all they found was ashes of these people. During the investigation, over 40 people came forward to admit that they killed these girls, raped and killed these girls.
Wow.
So whenever you open it up to the public, you never know who's going to decide they want their name in a book and are going to come forward and make up some amazing story. So that is a huge thing in Roswell that, you know, time after time after time, people were proven not to have been involved, not have been there, you know, could not know that information, or just completely fabricated it. And some of it is really good fiction. Don't get me wrong. Some of that stuff that came out is really good fiction. So I just went back to the original people and said, okay, these are the people that were actually involved in the cover-up. And the Air Force is still saying it wasn't a cover-up, even though they said that what they did was to mask the operation of the Mogul balloon that was listening to the Soviets waiting for us to hear them detonate a nuclear bomb, which would have been a classified type thing. It would have been a secret thing. But they still say it wasn't a cover-up, and it absolutely was. And so what I did was is I reviewed all that stuff, all the stuff that happened then, and then I did a forensic statement analysis of how the Air Force did the investigation, and they lied. Anybody that knows anything about forensic statement analysis will tell you that these guys were full of it. They did a horrible job at documenting the people that they interviewed. They were smug, and I mean, they did a horrible job. I would have had a real problem with the investigation had I been supervising that. So that's where I come from.
And understanding that it's pretty clear that a cover-up occurred and that the Air Force lied, what do you believe happened? We've heard so many different stories and so many different theories from people that presumably know. But other than that there was dishonesty, what do you believe happened in terms of the possibility of an alien craft?
So the possibilities of an alien craft, I would have to fall back on Jesse Marcel, or, you know, the major Jesse Marcel, on what he initially reported. And he initially reported this material that was not of this world, Earth, right? Not of this world. So whatever this object was, we know that there was and I use the word loosely, there was a crash of something. And it left material there. And Jesse Marcel and Sheridan Cabot and Bill Rickett went out and collected this material and brought it back to the Roswell Army Airfield. At that point, it got transferred over to Carswell Air Force Base, their Fort Worth Army Airfield. And it is my belief, based on what the five photographs that have this stuff in that are still existing, that material was not the material that that Jesse Marcel brought there. Now, there's some real controversy with that because Irving Newton was a weather guy there, and he was brought in to identify this material as a weather balloon, which it was. And if it was Mogul, it could have been parts of a weather balloon that made up the Mogul balloon chain of a lot of balloons, a lot of sound equipment, and some transmission things. But if they swapped it out, it would still be weather balloon stuff. So quite, you know, if he walks in there and they've switched it out, of course he's going to laugh and go, yeah, it's weather balloon stuff. You going to tell me an intelligence officer. I don't care how incompetent he is. He's seen hundreds, if not thousands, of these balloons because they launched them constantly. And so this isn't anything strange. Some of the material could have been strange if it was part of Mogul, but that's not where they went at that point. And also that, you know, when the Air Force, people say, well, of course, Greg, the Air Force lied about it. Of course. Okay. Why are they still lying 70 years later?
Well, that was my next question. If people are just tuning in, by the way, we're talking with Greg Lawson. He's the author of the book Roswell, the After Action Report. He's a military veteran, a paranormal explorer, and he's written a lot of interesting books. 74 years later, why still so much secrecy? No more Soviet Union. Almost everybody involved in what happened at Roswell is gone. And I'm just so curious, why is there still such why is this still such a sensitive subject for our intelligence agencies and the military?
So the end of the Roswell report, you know, the Roswell reports came out in 1994, 95, and, you know, case closed. We're done with this. There were still three or four people that were still alive at that point that had seen that material, had worked with Mogul material, and that had seen whatever the material was that Jesse Marcel collected, which would have been his son was still alive at that time, Jesse Marcel Jr. And so it doesn't make any sense even then for them to still be deceptive. And see, that's the thing that I'm throwing out there. I don't know what they're lying about. I have no clue of what they're lying about. Here's the issue. So you can be trained in, let's say, cognitive interview, right? And then you can be trained in body language. And you can get somebody, this has happened to me before, get somebody in your office that is a suspect in a murder. And you interview them for 4 hours and you collect up 27 times this person was deceptive to you based on cognitive interview approach and body language, which I can prove. And you sit there and you go, wow, this guy committed this murder. This guy committed it. He's my suspect. This guy did it. Come to find out, he was being deceptive because he had a couple of pounds of weed in his car that was parked in my parking lot, in the law enforcement parking lot. He didn't want us to get into his car, you know. So this deception, he was lying to me, but he didn't have anything to do with the murder. He just didn't want me to look in his car, right? So there are certain things that people do, and that is what was so fun for me writing this. Was to look at how the Air Force conducted the investigation. And I literally laughed out loud multiple times and said, you know, stood up from my desk. Oh my God, I can't believe that they got away with doing this. You know, it's just crazy. How in the world, a supervisor didn't see this. But the thing about it was, is the guy that conducted the investigation was the supervisor. And he had a supervisor above him that probably didn't have that much experience doing investigations. And they're just like, hey, man, you need to make this go away. And he says, okay. And he goes and does it.
I can't wait to read the book. If people want to check it out, it's called Roswell, the After Action Report. It's available in e-form if you want to get it for your Kindle. It's available in paperback. Check out Greg's website, theparanormalinvestigator.com. Hey, Greg, I really enjoyed the conversation. I hope you'll come back soon.
Well, thanks. It's theparanormaldetective.com.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said investigator.com. Believe me, come this time of morning, you make a few mistakes like that. Theparanormaldetective.com. Greg Lawson. Thanks so much, Greg.
Thank you, man. Bye.
If you want to comment on any portion of our discussion, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Killing from the rain, it does stay on the air.
Duran Duran, Ordinary World. That is a Matt Blaze selection. If you want to know the kind of bumper music we play on this show, all you have to do is join our Facebook group. Just go on Facebook and search Morano Radio Fans and Haters. That's M-O-R-A-N-O Radio Fans and Haters. And we'll post each of the titles and artists to all the songs that we play throughout the show. I have made a big mistake this week. I have not brewed a new batch of Life Change tea. And I got to tell you, I am feeling the effects of it. I do not have that extra spring in my step that I normally do. Now, if you've not heard me talk about Life Change Tea from GetTheTea.com, you really ought to. In fact, I think we're going to try and talk with the CEO of Life Change Tea tomorrow. It's a great product. It gives you a ton of energy without caffeine. It detoxifies you. It cleanses you from the inside out. It's a gentle daily cleanse. It's a cold tea. It's delicious. Comes in three great flavors. You drink two glasses of this stuff every day. It cleans out your insides. That's why they call it the tea that makes you go. And boy, oh boy, does it make you go. Not only does it make you go to the restroom, but it makes you go in terms of energy. So if you want to try this stuff, you can get one package. It lasts you a whole month. Go to the website, GetTheTea.com. That's GetTheTea.com and use the promo code FRANK. And you can enjoy free shipping anywhere in these United States. That's GetTheTea.com, promo code FRANK. And you get not only the tea, but all the other great products they sell on there with free shipping anywhere in the country. GetTheTea.com, promo code FRANK. You will like it. You'll enjoy it. You'll thank me. Now, coming up a little bit later, we have Jeffrey Lichtman. If you want to follow what we're doing, where I post a lot of interesting articles related to the show, you're going to make sure to follow our Facebook page, facebook.com/MoranoFan. That's facebook.com/MoranoFan. You know what I've noticed on Facebook? I don't know if anybody else has noticed this, but sometimes people message me and it seems like they're not messaging me intentionally. And they'll ask me questions like, do you have a minute to chat? Or, can you tell me more about your background? And I always say, no, I don't really have a minute to chat. Or, no, I can't tell you more about my background. I say it all on radio. So for instance, I was messaging with one woman the other day and I get a message. It says, can you tell me more about yourself? And I said, what do you want to know exactly? And then she says, that's so weird. I didn't type or send it. No idea of where it came from. And I said, I see. Okay. She said, I don't need to know anything more about you. Have a good day. Another woman, the message from her that keeps coming is, can I learn more about your background? It was sent 1, 2, 3, 4 times in a row. Or are you available to chat? So I don't know if that's a Facebook thing. I don't know if that's a function of somehow people are selecting the wrong button, because I'm getting it now from multiple people. And a lot of them, when I respond to them, they act like they are in the dark in terms of what, you know, what it is that I'm responding to. So 800-848-WABC, facebook.com/MoranoFan. We're even on Instagram at Morano Vision. Larry is in Brooklyn. Hello, Larry.
Oh, hi, good evening, Frank. You know, I wanted to challenge you on something you had said before.
Go ahead.
I really feel very strongly about it. I am totally, I feel that term limits is completely a ridiculous idea. I think one of the greatest things of our democracy is a guy like Chuck Grassley could go for another term. And there was Strom Thurmond at 96, who, you know, from South Carolina, and there was others that lived. I mean, this is the greatest thing, because the greatest experience that our democracy can, that democracy can have is when you vote a guy out, okay? That's like a tune-up for a democracy. Challenge them. Vote them out. What's the purpose? There's no purpose. The only term limits I would have is on a president, and it would be three terms like Roosevelt had, because you have to have it for a president in case a guy manipulates the system where he can be perpetually elected, like, and become a dictator. But it should be three terms. I don't understand why people like yourself just reflexively say term limits and then don't give any reasons for it.
Well, Larry, so I have 20 seconds here. So I'm going to address this after the top of the hour news with Molly Fichter, because you raise a lot of great points, and I'm going to do my best to respond to each of them. And then we had a lot of other great stuff, including Jeffrey Lichtman, still to come. But I am very much for term limits. I will explain why in mere moments. But first, here is the news with Molly Fichter. Until next hour, help control the pet population. Make sure you get your dog or cat spayed or neutered.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Everyone, this is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Couple of quick things here. One, I will get to all your calls. Two, I am going to talk with Jeffrey Lichtman coming up in about 20 minutes about a wide variety of legal issues. And three, you know, I was watching football on Sunday, and, you know, I kind of keep the football games on in the background as I prepare for the show. I read articles and so forth. And I got to tell you, I am still so annoyed every time I hear the commentators refer to the team as the Washington football team. It sounds ridiculous. The Washington football team and the Dolphins, the Washington football team. Oh, the Raiders are in action against the Washington football team. Pick a name. Pick a name. You don't want to be the Redskins. Pick another name. I don't care. Just pick a name. The Washington football team. It sounds so dumb. It's my opinion. It's been bothering me. Now, two, they are going to have New Year's Eve in Times Square again this year. And I was talking about this on the air with Juliette Huddy the other day. I cannot imagine any scenario in which I would want to be in Times Square on New Year's Eve. It looks so uncomfortable. It looks so, I don't know, it doesn't look fun. It also seems cold. So I'd be curious if you are ever a New Year's Eve person. Now, I do think that they have all sorts of COVID protocols this year that you have to go forward with in order to attend. I think you need a negative test and or a vaccination. But I'd love to know if someone's actually been to New Year's Eve on Times Square, what your impression of it was. 800-848-WABC, because clearly there is something to like about it. People come from all over the world to go. There's thousands of people there at the crossroads of the world. I will never be one of those people. But I'd love to know. It's one of those things that everyone says they want to do once. I don't want to do it once. I want to do it zero times. But if you've done it once, if you're one of those people, or even if you're one of those people that go every year, I'd love to know what's so great about it. I mean, I'm sure it is fun to be near the music and near where the ball is dropping. But for it to be that cold and you're locked into these areas, I think even something as simple as going to the restroom has got to be a real struggle. 800-848-WABC. Hey, speaking of COVID protocols, I am amazed that we are still seeing these outdated or unrealistic COVID practices implemented at level after level of government. For instance, despite overwhelming evidence of the drawbacks of remote education, Detroit Public Schools this week announced students would go remote on Fridays in December in an effort to reduce COVID outbreaks. And I recognize COVID is a serious thing. We actually passed an important milestone the other day in that more people died of COVID in the year 2021 than died in 2020. But I think the measures that public health authorities implement to try to slow down the spread or eliminate the spread, they've got to be based in reality. Our governor, Kathy Hochul, she recommended a couple of days ago that Americans who have family and friends over for indoor Thanksgiving celebrations remain masked and socially distant. Now, at this stage in the pandemic, who is really going to do that? Who's going to go to grandma's house? Who's going to go to their cousin's house, their brother's house, and remain masked and socially distant on Thanksgiving? Nobody. Nobody is. Nobody is. 800-848-WABC if you want to comment on any of those three things, the Washington football team, unrealistic COVID protocols, or Times Square Thanksgiving, Times Square New Year's Eve celebration. Now, the caller called in. I believe it was Larry in Brooklyn. Larry called in right before the top of the hour, and he said he's opposed to term limits, and people like me, and this is a fair criticism, people like me reflexively say that we're for term limits without offering any reason as to why. And he said he thinks it's a great thing when people like Chuck Grassley or Strom Thurmond can be elected again and again. And he thinks it's a great thing to be able to throw someone out of office. Okay. I get everything he's saying, and I actually used to be of the same view. When I was a child, I was opposed to term limits, and I still regret the need for them, but I am a big, big, big term limits supporter for almost every office. Certainly Congress, U.S. Senate, governor, mayor, city council. I do think it should be, even for the presidency, I've always thought it should be two consecutive terms, like it is here in New York City, so that maybe you could come back 4 years later and run again. Why am I for term limits? Well, I'm going to – for many reasons, but I'm going to give you a few basic answers. For starters, hey, I'd have no problem if we just put this on the ballot. Let's put it on the ballot in New York. Do you want term limits? Do you not want term limits? And let's let the people vote, because almost everywhere term limits has been on the ballot, it's passed. Because the people want it. The people want to throw a lot of these bums out. Now, the other reason that I'm for term limits, incumbents, when you have an incumbent running for reelection, particularly at the congressional or state legislative level, they are overwhelmingly favored to win. Is it possible they lose? Yes. But what more often than not happens is not only do they win, but they're not even seriously opposed. You see, people not wanting to run. They instead wait until there's an open seat. So you end up with no competitive elections in a whole bunch of congressional and state legislative elections. And I don't think that's good for the voters. I think competitive elections are good for the voters. Have both candidates or all three candidates or all 10 candidates, however many there are, put their records before their voters, their ideas before the voters, and make their case to the voters. You get that when there's an open seat due to term limits. You saw that with a lot of city council seats in New York this year. You don't usually get it when, unless it's a hyper-competitive district, you don't usually get it when it's an incumbent running for reelection. And part of the reason why is because that big money goes overwhelmingly to the incumbents. 97% of corporate PAC money goes to the incumbents because the lobbyists and the special interest groups already have them in their back pocket. So term limits breaks that up a little bit. It creates competitive elections, and it opens things up a little bit. You get some new blood and new ideas. And that's one of the other reasons that I'm for this. One of the things that I've seen in politics – take a sip here. One of the things that I've seen in politics, particularly at the congressional or state legislative level is a huge problem with groupthink. These politicians live in a bubble where they become a little bit disconnected from the average ordinary guy. Not all of them. Some of them, like Peter King, for instance, they remain very grounded. But so many of these politicians, they get exposed to other politicians, to lobbyists, to other bureaucrats, and to government officials, and to labor leaders, and to business leaders. They become very separated from the people whose conversations they would overhear on the bus on the way to work. And I think that term limits, getting some new people in there every 6 years or every 8 years, it prevents that groupthink from settling in. And the examples that that the caller gave of Chuck Grassley and Strom Thurmond, I think what so often happens when you have an incumbent, particularly a legendary incumbent like Strom Thurmond of South Carolina or Chuck Grassley of Iowa, is they get reelected mostly based on their prior career. They get reelected based on their name recognition. They get reelected based on what they've done rather than what they are going to do. And look, if you look at Strom Thurmond, he served in the U.S. Senate until he was 100. I don't know what age that Strom Thurmond was no longer a functional senator, but there came a time where Strom Thurmond was no longer a functional senator. You'd look at him up there in the Senate. The guy could barely speak. The guy clearly had no understanding of what was going on, at least no visible understanding to the rest of the public. The guy, it was almost like, I hate to use this analogy, but it was almost like the movie Weekend at Bernie's. He was just an empty vessel up there, controlled and run by his staff. And I think the big losers in that whole situation are, one, the people of South Carolina, two, the people of the United States, and three, the other senators that are on the committees that he serves on. And I don't see that being a good thing at all. So is there an element that's undemocratic to term limits? Sure, I can absolutely see that. But that's why I like my proposal of non-consecutive terms for a president. Making it term limits consecutive terms. For a president, serve two consecutive terms, then you could come back in 4 years or in 8 years and run. For a senator, make it 12 years. You could serve 12 years, and then you can come back 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, and run. I think that's a good, healthy opportunity for the public to keep returning people that they like. And at the same time, get a little bit of turnover. So that's some of the reasons that I'm for term limits. I hope that's clear. And one of the things that term limits also does, and we've seen this in New York, where we have term limits for the city council, but not for the state legislature, is you have all these ambitious politicians who then start running for other offices and giving other politicians a run for their money. And it creates sort of a ripple effect of people who you know, are competing for other offices. And then the big winner in those races is, again, the voters. So I think that makes sense. I hope it does. Because the advantages of the incumbency, while they're not impossible, they are overwhelming. And I think none of these people are essential. And one of my favorite quotes was from Mike Bloomberg. Ironically, it was from before he overturned term limits in New York to allow himself a third term. And he used to say in private business, he would, whenever he met somebody who claimed that they were irreplaceable, inevitably that was someone whose replacement did a better job. Nobody's irreplaceable. Nobody. Not in business, not in politics, not in radio. And I think the fact that these politicians believe, even though the public is overwhelmingly in support of term limits, the fact that these politicians believe that they're the only ones that can serve the public, it is the height of arrogance. 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. Rick is in New Jersey. The original Rick. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, Frank. Long
morning.
Time no talk.
Yes.
About the New Year's Eve thing, you know, I got forced into it because they closed my nightclub I was working at 10 p.m. New Year's Eve. They raided it and closed it. So I was working for Plato's Retreat.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they closed it. Yeah, that, we'll have a discussion about that someday, Frank. It'll blow your mind. But they closed it at 10 p.m. because they were spanking Larry Levinson for calling Mayor Koch a faggot on the radio.
Yeah, you can't say that on the radio.
No, you can't. On the radio, I can't say it?
No.
I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know that. But that's what he called him, and that's why they closed him down. You're still there, right?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Oh, okay. I didn't know. We had nothing to do. Me and one of the girls working there said, well, let's walk up to Times Square. What the heck? We're right here. We're only about 10 blocks away. So we walk up there. Frank, you don't want to go there. You really don't.
What year was this? It was, like 81?
19, what was it? No. It was closed down in 87, I believe. It was like 80. That was when Plato's Retreat moved up downtown to 10th Avenue.
So tell me, and I think it's only grown in terms of the sheer number of people that go since then, but what makes it so bad? Why wouldn't you go?
Okay, well, first of all, those were the days it was free range, I call it. They didn't have you blocked off.
Mm.
There was no block. Everyone was just in the street. Remember when it was just everybody in the street? And so it's too tight. There's maybe now with it being blocked off or whatever. But I remember when when the ball came down, I jumped up in the air to say, yay. I had to wiggle myself back down to the ground because the crowd was pushing so tight that my feet weren't touching the ground anymore. I had to wiggle back down. And then you're stuck there. Like when everybody goes away, there's like a million people or whatever is there, and you want to go left and the other person wants to go right, and everybody wants to go a different direction, and I got pushed like down this street and then over to this street, and you were just like, you had no control over anything at that point. It was just chaos. It was horrible. And there's also was another thing I caught my whatever, a guy was going through the crowd saying, everybody watch your wallets. Everybody watch your wallets. And instinctively, everybody went and felt where their wallet is. And that guy, that was the scam. He had lookers out looking.
Oh, boy.
The pickpockets know where it is now.
Mm.
You see? Mm. So, yeah, it's just a scam. And, you know, now you can't have anything to drink. You can't move for four. You got to wear diapers or something.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. It sounds horrible. I'd love to know the people that have a good time doing this. I don't get it. Rick, thanks for the call. Thanks for the stroll down memory lane. Lenny is in Bethpage. Hello, Lenny.
Hey, Frank, how are you?
Good.
I just wanted to talk to you about, you compared Biden and Trump, and you know, Biden can't put two sentences together, but you said Trump was the second oldest president, but that's not true either.
So who was the second oldest president?
Well, Reagan was older than Trump, but you said like Trump lost a step. But meanwhile, Trump gave most interviews, most press conferences, answered most questions.
Well, no doubt about it. Look, I'm a Trump supporter, and I voted for him.
I know you.
I voted for him twice. But like, if you look at the interviews that he was doing 20 years ago, he does not look like the same guy to me. I mean,
he was on top. Listen, I think he was on top of his game. He's walking out to the helicopter. He was giving more press interviews and time than any other president. So when you said he lost a step,
he was always very high functioning. Always very high functioning, Lenny. But if you look at, you know, the kind of vocabulary that he was using, if you look at his interviews with Oprah, for instance, or his interviews with Mike Wallace or Rona Barrett, he has a different there's something different there. Now, again, I would agree.
Agreed.
But that unfortunately comes with the job. And so what I meant to say
Biden hides in his basement.
Well, that's true. But Lenny, what I was meant to say about Trump is that he was not the second oldest president at the time that he left. He was the second oldest president at the time that he took office, which
I don't think that's true.
Yeah, he was 70 years and 220 days old.
How old?
He was 69 years and 349 days old.
I'm not sure about that. But you know,
He was born February 6, 1911, and then he took office January 20th, 1981. So at what age would that make him?
Okay. But you know what? I don't think he lost a step. I think he was just under attack.
And Reagan or Trump?
I like him. I know you like him and I like him. But to compare him to Biden and cognitive function.
Biden is in a separate category. But the issue is, Lenny, when you get to be in your mid to late 70s, and if Trump is elected in 2024, he'll be 78. He'll be 3 years older than he is now. When you're in your mid to late 70s, nobody, I don't care if you're the smartest guy in the world, the best, the healthiest guy in the world, the most in shape guy in the world, nobody is as sharp mentally as they were when they were 55. There's nobody on the planet.
Like everybody talks about a year or 2 years, 3 years. Like in politics, you know, because you're involved, 6 months is forever in politics.
Oh, well, you see, a week is a lifetime. I mean, you talk about 6 months. Look at what was happening 6 months ago. People were saying Andrew Cuomo was either going to be president, vice president, or U.S. attorney general. Now people are trying to determine whether Andrew Cuomo is going to lose his $5.1 million or whether he's going to prison.
You know politics, and when people talk about a year or two or three, it's meaningless. DeSantis, Trump, Kamala, no one knows what's going to happen.
Well, you're right about that. Here's the difference, though, Lenny. Here's the difference. You're right. But it now costs so much money to run for president that you have to spend 2.5 years fundraising in order to be able to have a chance at being competitive. So all the candidates you just mentioned, if they're going to run in 2024, well, Trump's already fundraising, but all those candidates are going to have to raise $200 million to have an opportunity to compete.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Eric Adams seems I know you, and I was a big Curtis supporter too. What do you think? Like, he seems like he's saying the right thing.
Yeah, so far I've been very pleased with most of what he said. I think, there was one tweet, I don't remember who it was from, but it was from a journalist. There was one tweet that this journalist said, come after 4 years of an Eric Adams mayoralty, there is nothing that would surprise me. You could tell me after 4 years that this guy was the best mayor of all time, or that wouldn't surprise me, or you could tell me he's running for vice president with Donald Trump on a platform of police should be able to shoot jaywalkers, and that wouldn't surprise me either. Eric Adams, and the New York Times, I think, did a good job chronicling this in their front page story on him. Eric Adams is a total wild card. You never know. You never know what you're going to get with Eric Adams. Are you going to get the Eric Adams that says, bring your gun to church? Are you going to get the Eric Adams that that's a conservative Republican and that's doing campaign events with Rudy Giuliani? Are you going to get the Eric Adams that's doing events with Louis Farrakhan and attacking Herman Badillo for marrying a Jewish woman? Are you getting the Eric Adams that's doing events with Al Sharpton? Are you getting the pro-Trump? Charter school Eric Adams? Are you getting the pro vegetarianism Eric Adams? The guy is a total wild card. So it is very exciting on the one hand. De Blasio was totally predictable. But we don't know. We don't know. I could see him being a great mayor, a terrible mayor, or something in between.
Can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
Well, when Rittenhouse, they jumped to conclusions right away, white supremacists and that. Now you have a person who drove over, 40 people. Nobody's jumping to conclusions. What's the difference?
Right. Well, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. Well, the one conclusion we can jump to, and maybe I'll get into this with Jeffrey Lichtman next, is this is a person that was given bail, and but for that, he probably would have still been in jail. I mean, this was a person that was not given bail. He was let out of jail, from my understanding, without bail. I mean, some of the details are still coming out. But if this is a person that had a tougher nut to crack in terms of bail, now bail is not meant to be punitive. It's meant to assure that you'll return to court. But what we've seen in New York, and I think it might have been the case in Wisconsin with this SUV driver, what we've seen in some of these states is essentially no bail for anything but the most violent crimes. And I think that could have resulted in multiple deaths in Wisconsin. Hey, we're going to talk with Jeffrey Lichtman about this next. He is a veteran criminal defense attorney and a guy with an opinion on every subject. This is The Other Side of Midnight, straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano here on 77 WABC. These days, believe it or not, it's actually a pretty rare thing to find a good trial attorney, particularly a criminal trial attorney. Now, you may think, why is that the case? Everywhere you go, everyone is a lawyer. Well, the reason is because there are so few trials, and it's so rare to find an experienced trial attorney that really knows how to master the art of cross-examination, the art of being persuasive before a jury, the art of holding a judge's attention, keeping a witness off their, off their prepared talking points, and really taking an unwinnable case and making it winnable. Now, it's an even rarer thing to find somebody that's a skilled radio commentator. Now, if you could find someone that's both, that's a once-in-a-lifetime talent. I'm very, very pleased to tell you that we have such a talent on the line with us this morning. Longtime criminal defense attorney and a terrific radio talk show host, the one and only Jeffrey Lichtman. Jeffrey, thanks so much for joining me on the radio.
Thanks for having me again, Frank. Much appreciate that intro. I mean, I'm just trembling with delight.
Well, again, I think you're trembling with sarcasm, which is dripping from about every syllable you utter most days. All right. I want to ask you about the Kyle Rittenhouse situation. A lot of so-called legal experts, they all predicted that he would be acquitted on at least the top charges and then thought maybe he'd be convicted of a lesser charge. What did you see happening with this case? And do you think the jury got it right here?
I thought it would always be either a straight acquittal on everything or an acquittal plus a hung jury. I never imagined he'd be convicted of anything. There's simply nothing there for him to be convicted of. This case should never have been brought. It couldn't have been more obvious that what he did, while it may not be palatable to some people, their beef is with the law. It's not with what Kyle Rittenhouse did, because what he did was within the bounds of the law. If you listen to the left-wing nutjobs, they'll tell you how terrified they are and how they feel that white supremacy won in that trial. Well, it was white-on-white crime. There was no white supremacy involved at all. If anything, the reason it occurred was because the left, the Democrats that run Wisconsin, abdicated their responsibility and forced a kid like Kyle Rittenhouse, who felt that he had to protect his community. With that gigantic gun that was almost as big as him. So this was a pretty straightforward case. You clearly had self-defense that existed here. You had people grabbing at his gun. They were chasing him. They were beating him. One of the victims had a gun. Anybody who had a weapon legally, as he did that night, would have been justified to use it.
And I want to reiterate one aspect of what you just said here, because there's such a temptation, and Rittenhouse even alluded to this in his interview with Tucker Carlson last night. There's such a temptation for those on the left to portray this guy as a villain, and such a temptation for the people on the right to portray this young man as a hero. It's very possible to think that he was buffoonish to take a weapon and play policeman at this riot, and that he shouldn't have the weapon, and then it's also possible to think the jury reached the right conclusion based on the law, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, was it buffoonish? Look, anytime you walk into a situation like that in an open carry state with a bunch of rampaging Antifa members who are setting businesses on fire, beating the crap out of people in the street, acting like complete animals, you know you're going into a situation that could end in disaster. So was it foolish? I suppose, but was also as foolish as the fact that the Democratic governor didn't call in the National Guard. He just simply allowed Kenosha to get burned to the ground. I mean, is that not foolish as well? So I respect what Kyle Rittenhouse did. I don't think I'd want that for my own son because it's too dangerous. The kid obviously had a huge pair of balls, bigger than his brain, clearly. But thank God he got out of this, and he was not the one that was injured. I think that for the rest of his life, he'll be certainly hunted down by leftists. He's got a target on his back. But this is what the country is nowadays, Frank. It's completely divided. If you listen to the leftists, the pundits on TV and on the radio, they're just so mortified. Even criminal defense lawyers, because 99% of them are leftists, are just mortified that he got acquitted. You know, this was an obvious acquittal here. And I try to be objective with these cases, regardless of my personal politics. But this wasn't even a close call. That's how easy this case was. It never should have been brought.
Very quickly, yesterday, a new report from the State Assembly Judiciary Committee released the findings into their investigation into former Governor Andrew Cuomo. They found not only was there overwhelming evidence of sexual harassment, but they found that he used his staff to his government staff to work on his book and benefit himself and profit. They also found that he and his office deliberately misled the public and government regulators about the true number of COVID deaths. We've seen at least one charge brought. It looked like that was maybe jumping the gun a little bit in Albany County. What do you think the likelihood is of Andrew Cuomo facing criminal prosecution around the state for any of the charges outlined in this report?
Well, I think the fact that he misled the public and fudged some of the documents, for that he should be indicted. Do I think he's going to go to jail? No. Do I think there's really any point to it? Probably not, because he's already out of office. But you know that this creepy, disgusting, lizard-like, lying piece of garbage, you know he's thinking about a political comeback. And in this state, which is so disturbed with the vast majority of leftists that live here, you know, they're dumb enough to vote for this guy again. They voted for de Blasio twice. They voted for a guy like that Wiener. Who knows what they're capable of? And I think that's one of the reasons why there's been a pursuit of criminal charges against him, is that his opponents want to basically end him, want to end his career forever. So I don't think it really makes any point. I think that if I had a loved one who died in a nursing home, I think I'd be a little more pissed. But at this point, I think you just want to drive a stake through the heart of his political career so we never have to see his lecherous, disgusting, lizard-like features again.
So at this point, what do you think is more likely, a criminal conviction on something, whether it's the sexual stuff, or any of the other charges that we've discussed, or him being elected to public office again? Which is more likely?
I think the chances of him being elected are pretty, pretty low. I think the chances of him being convicted of any kind of sex charge are probably close to zero. He's got a white-collar lawyer who's never handled a case like this in her life. And her level of shrillness as a defense lawyer is about a 12, probably like a Spinal Tap 12. So I don't think that she would be the best choice as a trial lawyer, but I still think it's impossible for him to be convicted. You know, this complainant gave 17 different stories. It's a he said, she said. There's really not enough evidence. I think it's really a waste of time. Go after him for the stuff that matters, which is the fudging of the records regarding the deaths in the nursing homes. things like that, lying to the public. You know, there's stuff that if you want to go after them about something that matters.
We spoke back in February or March about your representation of Emma Ispuro, the wife of El Chapo. You represented El Chapo in a trial that got a lot of international attention. It was certainly a big case here in New York. But now we're reading that the Justice Department is seeking a four-year prison term for Ms. Ispuro. What do you think of that in terms of a sentence? Is that fair, given the charges that she's pled to?
Well, her sentencing guidelines, and this is what really advises the judge. I mean, when the case started, of course, the press, which knows nothing about anything when it comes to criminal work, has said that, you know, she's going to spend the rest of her life in jail. Well, the government, when the case started, basically said that her involvement was she helped him escape from prison in Mexico, and she basically lived in his houses that were paid for with drug proceeds and spent the money that he gave her, which was drug proceeds. When you consider the size of the conspiracy, her involvement was a fraction, a tiny fraction. So we initially thought the guidelines were around 7 years or so. It ends up that we found an error in them last Sunday. I submitted it to the prosecutor and the probation department. They agreed, and the guidelines were knocked down to under 5 years. The government made a recommendation of four. So the idea that she was going to spend the rest of her life in prison obviously was a joke, as I predicted. 4 years, I think she actually deserves less, because I think that you have to remember that she met Chapo when she was a minor, when she was 17. She married him on her 18th birthday. She's got two little girls that are in Mexico. The government made that horrible anonymous smear of her the day that she got arrested, that she was cooperating with the government, which basically put targets on her back and on the backs of her young daughters. So I think that for all of those reasons, I still think four is a little high. If I think what the right number is, if I had to guess, you know, less than three, two, something like that. She's had a miserable 9 months in prison. She's had no visits from any friends or family because they all live in Mexico. She's been in lockdown 22 hours a day. She doesn't speak the language. She only speaks Spanish. And it's been a very, very difficult 9 months for her. And I think for all those reasons, having been imprisoned also during the COVID period, where jails have not been the most pleasant places because of the lockdowns, I think that 2 years or so is appropriate.
I want to pick your brain on some international stuff as well. But by the way, if people are just tuning in, we're talking with Jeffrey Lichtman, distinguished criminal defense attorney, represented not only El Chapo, but John Gotti Jr. and a number of high profile clients, and continues to do so. If someone is arrested for something very serious, there's a good chance, particularly if they have money, that you will see Jeffrey Lichtman's name at the top of their list of possible attorneys. Jeffrey, the Ahmed Arbery case, it seems that's a much stronger prosecution case than the Rittenhouse case was. What's your take on that case from what you've seen of it?
I think there will be a conviction there. I think that there was certainly not the excuse that Kyle Rittenhouse had with regard to the use of force. You know, look, part of me, as someone who's, I suppose, an amused bystander, part of me hopes, obviously, I hope for an acquittal because I'm a defense lawyer, but I'm also strong against crime as a human being. But as a conservative, I suppose, I wouldn't say that I'm a right winger, as you know, I'm a moderate. Part of me wants to see more acquittals because I'd like to see the left melt down. And there's a higher possibility that they'll be burning cities down. And I think it's important that the country see exactly what the left is. And an acquittal, although it wouldn't be fair in this case, I don't think it's the right verdict. It would perhaps trigger them to heights of madness never before seen. I mean, think about how crazy it is, Frank. You've got a guy, a lefty, a Hollywood lefty like that Mark Ruffalo. What does he play? The Hulk?
That's right.
Which is ironic, such a puny moron. He's referring to one of the victims in the Rittenhouse case by his nickname, JoJo. Well, you know, it's so sad. You know, poor JoJo got killed, and he deserved justice too. Well, JoJo was a convicted pedophile who spent many years in prison for raping children. And this is how sick the left is. They're so sick that they would use this as a hero, a convicted pedophile. One of the other victims was also in jail for strangling a woman. The guy that got his arm half blown off also had a criminal record and was violent that night. I mean, this is just so sick that they would take a kid like Rittenhouse, who had no history of violence, who, by all accounts, was simply trying to protect his community, even if it was completely misguided and foolish, and they would take a pedophile over just a kid like that. Why? Because they felt that he was a Republican, and therefore he's a white supremacist. We even had this jackass pile of crap, the president, who's got mush for brains. I mean, literally has mush for brains. There's mush inside his head. He had a 90 IQ. When he was smart, when he was younger, and he was 40 years old, he was an idiot. Now he's, I don't know, 97. He can barely speak without having a puddle of drool underneath it by his feet. When he had the gall to call him a white supremacist, a kid like that, that's outrageous. It was a smear. And the last president who did that, if you remember, was Obama, when he smeared the cops when they had the run-in with the Harvard professor.
Right. Skip,
same thing.
Professor Gates
and
Sergeant Joe Crowley. Obviously, it's a different situation because this was in the midst of while a trial was going on, and there was no charges for Sergeant Crowley. So I'm putting you on the Arbery case as saying that the evidence doesn't support a conviction, but the evidence does support a conviction, but your rooting interest may support an acquittal. I'll put
just
you down
own,
as that.
Own perverse delights.
Got
you
it.
Understand.
All right. Now, I would characterize your politics these days anyway. And look, we go through different phases in our life and you see how the world changes and people's politics shift. I would characterize your politics, particularly on foreign policy, as basically neoconservative. I think that particularly when it comes to the Middle East, you tend to be pretty hawkish. That's why you were one of the people I was very eager to talk to about President Biden's plan to restart indirect, what they're calling indirect negotiations in Vienna with Iran over their nuclear program and the limits on the Iranian nuclear program. Give me your take on where you see these negotiations going.
I mean, I don't see how. Look, I hear you that I'm a neoconservative because I think that Iran, the mullahs in Iran, shouldn't exist. But think about how insane this is. They're claiming that they want good faith negotiations with the Americans, that they can be trusted, that they want peace. And at the same time, in the days leading up to these negotiations, let's see, they had their proxies, their terror proxies, send rockets at our troops in Iraq. They've attacked our troops in Syria. Let's see, they paid their paid terrorists in Palestine or the West Bank, whatever you call it, their Judea, Samaria, or the West Bank, killing an innocent Israeli yesterday inside Israel, not in any allegedly occupied area. They're basically causing mayhem in Saudi Arabia. They're hijacking ships. They're trying to overthrow or unsettle Bahrain, Iraq, Yemen with the Houthis, Syria. They're helping Assad gas people. I mean, my God, in Lebanon, they completely destroyed the country with Hezbollah. They're Hezbollah paid terrorists there. At what point do the Iranians simply take a breath and decide we're going to try one day to go without terrorism? You know, like when you're in a nuclear factory like Homer Simpson, there's a sign up. There's been X number of days since there's been a workplace accident. How about one day where they don't commit terrorism all over the world? They're getting having their diplomats arrested in Europe for trying to kill or killing people over there. And they say with a straight face that they want to negotiate in good faith. We should be saying, listen, you're going to get the backs of our hands. You go near our ships over there, and we're going to simply blow up your ships. The fact that Biden is doing nothing, they could barely even criticize the Hamas murder of the Israeli citizen yesterday because they don't want to offend the people that pay Hamas, Iran. Biden is releasing zillions of dollars that were frozen to the Iranians. The actions have already started. Although the talks haven't officially started, the releasing of money, the loosening of sanctions against Iran have already started. They're allowed to sell gasoline. They were never before under Trump. They're certainly doing better. Where's that money going that we're giving them, Frank? Where's that proceeds of oil sales going? Well, it's going to their terror proxies that are killing Americans and killing our allies. The fact that Biden could be this stupid. You know, I suppose It's really just an extension of what Obama did. It's the same level of stupidity. And I defy anybody to tell me with a straight face, I don't care how idiotic left you are, that you think it's a good idea to give these terrorists money when they're giving them, they're saying that they're giving it to Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis. They're giving it to them, to Palestinian Islamic Jihad. They're thanking them. These terrorists are saying we couldn't exist and kill Americans and Jews without the money from Iran, and Biden keeps shoveling them money. I mean, it's almost preposterous to think that anybody could be this stupid. But you look at a guy who said that Hunter Biden is the smartest person that he's ever seen. His daughter's diary talks about inappropriate showers with him. This guy is a complete wreck of a mess. The fact that he won the White House is absolutely stunning to me. And I suppose he's going to run again, assuming that he's still alive. I mean, in a few years, it's just astonishing to me.
Jeff, I am pleased that you've calmed down so much, and you're in the spirit of the Thanksgiving holiday, and giving everybody a break. Jeff, it is always a treat to be able to chat with you. I appreciate the time. I look forward to doing it again soon.
Thanks so much, Frank, and have a good Thanksgiving.
You too, my friend. Best to the family. If you want to comment on any portion of my discussion with Jeffrey Lichtman, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
This actually, believe it or not, this was the song that my wife and I had our first dance to at our wedding. And it's interesting. We practiced this a couple of times so that, I'm not much of a dancer, but I didn't want to look like a total schlemiel. So we practiced a couple of times. And what happened is we were dancing and you know how you wear a boutonniere, you wear a flower on your lapel as a groom. And when I spun her, or when she spun, I don't remember the circumstances exactly, she caught her finger on the needle of my boutonniere, and she started bleeding in the middle of our dance. But nobody really knew that she was bleeding. But and then everyone started coming over to say congratulations and stuff, but she just is trying to avoid getting blood on her dress. But my friend Derek Tobacco ultimately did notice that she was bleeding and gave her a napkin or something to wrap it up. But that was that. I mean, you really, if you think about it, if you know me, that's the only way that could have gone down. Now, we do collect your letters. I have not gotten snail mail from you in a while. I don't know if that's because something's going on with our P.O. box or if it's because you haven't been sending it. But if you want to send me anything in the mail, you can send it to P.O. Box 1777. My attention, Frank Morano, New York, New York, 10163. P.O. Box 1777. Attention, Frank Morano, New York, New York, 10163. Obviously, especially if there's checks, we like that a lot. But in the meantime, if you don't want to pay the price of postage, just send me an email for free. That's frank.morano@wabcradio.com. And we have quite a few emails.
Those letters. Let's find out what you got to say.
Oh, boy!
Mailman, mail today.
This, email comes to us from Tom, sent to me during the Bernie Getz interview. If you touch on Getz's case, you might ask him, did he or did he not say on leaving the train, you don't look so bad, here's another, as he shot one of the muggers again? I've never heard him answer that, though he may have answered it. I don't know. That's from Tom. Excellent question, Tom, and that is one of the most enduring myths of the Bernard Getz case. And do you know where that myth comes from? That comes from Bernard Getz himself. Remember, after Bernard Getz fled the scene, he then turned himself in New Hampshire on New Year's Eve, and he himself told police that he said that. And he himself told police that it was right before he shot one of the muggers a second time. The fact of the matter is, it didn't happen. He said it happened when he talked to the police December 31st, 1984. It never happened. These men, all four of them, were examined by two New York City medical examiners, and none of the men were shot twice. None of them were shot twice. So Bernie may have thought that he said that in his brain under the stress of what happened. He might have thought that he shot one of them twice. None of them were shot twice, and nobody on the train, including the people that he shot, heard him say that. The only place where that came from was from Bernie's own head. None of them were shot twice, and it doesn't appear that he said that. This email comes to us from Michael. Did you know, if you ask Alexa from Amazon and also on Android phones, play the podcast The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, she does it right away with good voice commands. Works great. I always use my phone, but when I'm working, I don't like to use my phone. In case I get an email, I miss the phone beep. This is very good advice for you guys. Thank you to Michael for this. So, or if you want to hear the podcast, if you have Alexa, all you have to do, apparently, is say, play the podcast The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano. That is certainly good information to have. Hey, this is an email from Linda. Frank, when Juliet first did the news with you, I never gave her a chance. Now, I think the news you both do from 5 to 6 is the best and most informative of the day. Thank you, Frank and Juliet. Please accept my apologies. Well, that's awfully nice of you, Linda. It takes a mature adult to recognize when one is wrong, and I appreciate you giving us multiple opportunities. So, thank you. Michael Gorgia, I want to this is a gentleman who lost the... He won a cap, the Other Side of Midnight cap. Michael Gorgia, I want to thank you both for the awesome swag. I will proudly wear my hat, so look for me around Staten Island. Happy Thanksgiving to the entire ABC family. Thank you, Michael Gorgia. Very nice of you. This is a comment. This is actually a Facebook comment from David. Loyal listener here. You've been my favorite WABC host for quite some time now. That is up till a few moments ago. This was sent yesterday. You pull the carpet out from underneath your sagacity when you berate another host on the station. I'm referring to the scabrous, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, scabrous comments you just made about Curtis's body odor. I'm not talking about one-on-one banter between hosts, but the insulting manner in which you talked about Curtis at the start of your show. I never met Curtis in person, but it's putative that he has serious health issues, not to mention that he's a very hard worker. These observations notwithstanding, do you actually expect him to smell like a tulip? I'm not in the radio business, so I don't know what WABC's policy is, if any, about hosts insulting other hosts. But if I owned a radio station, that would be a fireable offense. Is that the kind of conduct? As that kind of conduct can't be anyone's idea of widening a listening audience, could even discourage advertisers and sponsors. I don't even know how to respond to that. Please. I don't even know where to begin with that one. All right. That is about all the time that we have for mail. I mean, Curtis and I have a very good relationship. Believe me. The things that Curtis has said about me over the years on the radio, you compare that to me just recognizing the fact that he smelled yesterday. Come on. There's no comparison. And it's done with good fun. I showed Curtis that email from David. He got quite a chuckle out of it. He enjoyed it. All right. That is about it for the mail. Another letter from our listener. And Until next hour, your influence counts, so use it.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. You know, I do have a few other emails here that I may read throughout the course of the hour that are pretty entertaining. And I hate to have the fact that we ran out of time prevent me from sharing them with you. But if we don't get to them today, maybe we'll go over them tomorrow. But I am just about ready to be done with Mayor Bill de Blasio. These last 12 years since he's been in citywide office have really been taxing. And now that he wants to run for governor, he wants to be more taxing, literally. He wants to institute new taxes on the wealthy to pay for education. Mayor Bill de Blasio on Sunday sought to burnish his legacy as he took some steps towards a run for governor, promoting his education record and a statewide year-round schooling proposal. Now, I don't know how you feel about de Blasio, but the polling indicates, even among Democrats, he's not very popular. He's one of the – he and Andrew Cuomo are the only two people in the poll that Molly Fichter just cited that have higher negative poll numbers than positive poll numbers. They're the only two candidates. So clearly, even among Democrats, he's not exactly Mr. Popularity. But I am curious what you think of his proposal to allow for year-round schooling. Curtis proposed something similar when he ran for mayor. And I'm curious what you think of it. We asked you, I think, at the time that Curtis was running, what you thought of it. And now I'm asking you about what your view is on this Mayor de Blasio plan. So he's doing this series of campaign style speeches in Harlem at churches. And the mayor touted his newly announced proposal to give New York State students an option for summer school. So it wouldn't be mandatory, at least not yet. That's the plan at this point. He would give them an option for summer school and expand after school programs for them, initiatives that would be funded by increased taxes for the wealthy. He said, quote, "Here's what I want to create in this city, in this whole state. Every family should have a guarantee. Every family should know that your child can be in a safe, positive place, not just until the school day ends at 2:30 or 3 o'clock, but until the end of the afternoon, the end of the workday. It should be a guarantee." Made those remarks at the Bethel Gospel Assembly Church. "It should be a right for every family to know that if you want your child there the whole day long, you can have that." Now, I got to say, when I was a child, we did have that. It was part of a latchkey program, and you could stay until, if your parents worked or whatever the case may be, you could stay until, you know, 4:30, 5 o'clock, 5:30, 6 o'clock, whatever the case may be, I think even later. And it was fun. There was games. If there was nice weather, you'd play outside, and you'd play kickball and basketball. And if it was not nice weather, you'd play indoor games, Connect Four, knock hockey, number board. It was fun. There'd be a snack, and it was free. It sounds like what Mayor de Blasio is proposing is for that. Is the after-school aspect of this is similar to what I experienced with the latchkey program. But de Blasio then explained to parishioners at this church that he wants all New York State pupils to be able to spend their summer days in, quote, beautiful, positive settings modeled off of the new summer school program that City Hall dubbed Summer Rising. How about every family has a right in summer, if they want their child in a positive environment, if they want their child, yes, and the recreation, arts, and culture, that the fun, but also to get academic support throughout the summer to build them up. Remember, we used to hear about summer school, which was like if something went wrong, you got sent to summer school. Well, this takes this idea and puts it on its head and says, let's make summer a beautiful, positive time and give a universal right to all parents. What do you think of this idea? 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. That's the question.
A question. Since before your sun burned hot in space and before your race was born, I have awaited a question.
I have to say, as far as de Blasio ideas go, I don't think it's the worst idea. I do think that that there should be, for public school students, an opportunity for them to enjoy recreation and academic support both after school and in the and even during the summer. I remember there used to be, and I didn't know that it was no longer there, but there used to be an opportunity for summer school and summer school programs, not as a punishment, but as supplemental programs or daycare, essentially, for parents that needed it, through something called the Beacon Program. I don't know what happened with that. Obviously, I'm not for taxes for the wealthy, because here in New York, the wealthy are already taxed to the max, and I don't really want them moving out of New York City in even greater numbers than they are now, or out of New York State, because, look, this is all a prelude to Mayor de Blasio running for governor. But on the merits itself, I'd love to know what you think of this. 800-848-9222. And I'll go a step further. Do you think it might be time to make year-round schooling not just optional, but mandatory? If you look at how American students are doing compared to the rest of the world, we're not doing too well. We're not doing too well. We are near the top or at the top in a couple of categories: obesity and self-confidence. We are not anywhere near the top in terms of academic performance, in terms of reading ability, in terms of math ability. We are doing we are at or near the top in terms of obesity and self-confidence. I don't know that year-round schooling is the worst idea at this point. 800-848-WABC. I'm not ready to fully embrace this, but I'm ready to give it a second look. And I'm curious what your take on this is. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Let me begin with Paul on Staten Island. Hello, Paul.
Hey, what's up, Frank?
How you doing?
I'm all right. I'm working again.
Nice, good.
The amount of stretching out the amount of time they go to school is not going to help. It's the quality of the teachers that need to be better. Okay, what are you going to do? You're going to send them year-round now or never get a break. They get sent home with tons of homework. They have no break in the summer, and they got the same crappy teachers teaching them even longer. It's not the kids. The kids are smart. It's the teaching. All they care, these teachers' unions, all they care about is sitting home. All they care about is now they want to still stay home with the Zoom. They don't want to go back to work. It's ridiculous. And you got to see, I have two daughters. I have twins. And the amount of homework they come home with is crazy.
I believe it. And look, Paul, I won't dispute your characterization of the union leadership not having the best interests of the children at heart. I do think you might be right to some extent about that. But I really do think that there are a lot of not just good teachers, but great teachers in the New York City public school system.
But they're few and far between. I think there's more. There are less good teachers than there are. Like, there's more bad teachers than good.
See, that's where I part company with you. But let's say you're right. For the purposes of this discussion, let's say you're right. What about the parents that have a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old? I'm not talking about high school because high school's a different animal. But they have an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old, and they have to work in the afternoon or they have to work during the summer, and they don't really have the means to afford daycare for them or some sort of summer camp program. Would that be a viable way to provide for child care for these children?
Well, yeah, I guess that would help.
Yeah.
It would help, but, you know, every situation is different.
That's true. That's true, Paul. That's true. That's why, as far as de Blasio proposals go, this is not the worst that I've heard from him. And again, I recognize that he is running for governor. He's looking to promise the world he's looking to give out candy. That's what you do when you're running for office. Especially if you're running in a Democratic primary, if you could give out candy and add the sugar on top of the candy of taxing the rich, that's even sweeter. 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. What do you think of what de Blasio is proposing, number one? Number two, what do you think of the concept of mandatory year-round schooling? Mikey is in Brooklyn. Hello, Mikey.
Hey, good morning, Frank. How are you?
I'm great, Mikey. Thanks for asking.
Good Lord, I woke up and you're really an eye-opener.
Oh, well, that's awfully nice of you. Thank you.
But, okay, let me just cover this with the rich. I mean, you know, whatever, the wealthy, whatever. These people provide jobs for people, don't they? Or usually
absolutely.
Do?
Absolutely.
Okay, so they provide jobs. They also pass along, you know, whatever, you know, things that we buy, whatever, you know, companies that, you know. Why do we want to hurt these people? I mean, I don't understand.
Well, I agree with that, Mikey. That's what I was saying. I'm not for taxing the wealthy. But if they could, you know what? Because de Blasio trots this out every year for whatever his proposal is. He said, and we're going to pay for it through a tax on the wealthy. Remember, his signature accomplishment, universal pre-K, he initially wanted that to be funded with the tax on the wealthy. And that's where Andrew Cuomo came in and said, no. We're going to have the state pay for it. No tax on the wealthy. So I if there's some other way to pay for this, I kind of like part of this plan. So let's say there was no tax on the wealthy, Mikey. Would you go along with this kind of a plan?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
You know, I just wanted to pass this along and I think it's just common sense. This is common sense. Once you hit hit the wealthy or whatever you want to call them, rich, wealthy, whatever, and once you tax them up and really try to, you know, hit them up with all kinds of taxes and this and that and da da da, they got to pass it along to the consumer. They're going to have to raise their prices on the products they sell. On whatever they do,
or they'll just move. I mean, talk about a people that's very a group of people that's very mobile. The wealthy and the super wealthy are the most mobile among us. It's nothing for them to get a house in Florida and then spend 180 days a year there and make that their primary residence, and all of a sudden they don't have to pay anything in income taxes.
Thank you. And also, I just feel like with this year-round program, you know, for kids, you know, for children, whatever. That's not a bad idea in a way. But on the other, I mean, because times have changed where a lot of whatever you want to call it, if there's two people, in, you know, a husband and wife or a wife, whatever the case may be, they're both working or they're both, you know, out there. You know, it's not like years ago where, you know, one stayed home and the other one went to work and brought home the bacon, so to speak. And that was, you know, took care of the kids, blah, blah, blah. and watch the kids outside play and this and that. I mean, life is different today, I guess. You know, I you know, but as far as mandatory, I don't think that this mandatory this and mandatory that. I don't know where we're going with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I just wonder, Mikey, and thanks for the call, and I want to remind everyone again, please make sure you turn off your radio when you call. I wonder, we live in a world, a global economy. American students and American professionals are not just competing with students in their neighborhood and professionals in their state. Americans are now competing in every field with students and professionals around the world. And the bottom line is American students are falling behind. I think there are a number of reasons for that, but we are not keeping pace with, in terms of reading level, in terms of math, with students in China or Singapore or Europe or Canada. And I don't know how much longer that trend can continue and America still retains its place in the world. I mean, you think about it, every other country, not every other country, but there are several other, several dozen other countries that are churning out students that are better prepared for the world than our country is. And what's our reaction? In America, it seems to be to shrug our shoulders and say, oh, well, let's make sure there are no, there's no literature that's offensive to anybody. Let's assume the copy of To Kill a Mockingbird they're reading doesn't have the N-word in it. I mean, that's the only thing that seems to be getting fixed in schools is political correctness. You don't really seem to say that there doesn't really seem to be a movement towards fixing any of the problems in academia. I got to say, though, one of the people that is being talked about as Eric Adams' schools chancellor is somebody that has a pretty impressive record on education, and that is David Banks. If David Banks does get appointed as Eric Adams' schools chancellor, I think he is potentially somebody that may make some of these positive changes. He's a former principal himself, and he has done some great work on education. And he's an out-of-the-box thinker. And he is somebody who he launched something called the Eagle Academy, which is a group of public schools that have six campuses that serve minorities. And they have boosted graduation rates. They've improved the life outcome for the students who are often poorly served by these public education system. And he's now running a foundation that helps provide training and support for these schools. So if every school that's struggling in New York City could do what the Eagle Academy has done, I think New York City schools would be in pretty good shape. But I'm off on a little bit of a tangent here. Let me stay focused. Let me make sure you're focused on the question at hand. What do you think of the de Blasio proposal for optional summer school, number one? And number two, what if it wasn't optional? What if every child in New York State had to deal with mandatory summer school? 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Let me say hello to Ron in Michigan. Hello, Ron.
Hello, Frank. Frank, my wife's a teacher in Michigan, a Niles school system. It's not a real big town, but it's a pretty big town. And, you know, she teaches Spanish, but in her classes, her classroom, she really teaches civics, you know. Like she, I said, what, you know, like she was teaching about, you know, the current events, you know. And I said, do you ever teach them a Spanish word? And she says, yeah, I'll throw something in. But, you know, everybody loves her in her class, you know. But the thing
that's
of it
wonderful.
Is, it's the discipline in the schools. And there's a teacher shortage. You go ahead and lengthen the school year. You already got teacher burnouts, retirement.
Well, that's a great point, Ron. That's a great point. And I covered that the other day. I don't know if you heard the show that we did on that. But I mentioned earlier that in Detroit, in your state, what they're doing come December is they're switching back to remote learning on Fridays. They're saying it's because of COVID. I think it's really due to the teacher shortage.
I would agree with you there. And my wife hates that their remote learning stuff. You know, she wants to be in there with the kids. All right. And but the thing of it is here, I'll give you an example. Just the other day, a kid came in with a do-rag. OK, and there's no hats, no hoodies. OK. And in front of the principal of this middle school, my wife said to the principal, he's got to take that off. You know, And Principal says, well, we got to pick our battles here. And my wife said, that's a gang sign. She says, and if you let him get away with it, you're going to start seeing everybody in the school, you know, with this here gang affiliations. And the principal says to her, well, why don't you call the parent? And my wife says, that's not my job. That's your job. She says, if I call the parent, she's going to say, who are you? You're a teacher? You don't have. So, it's the management passing the buck, and it's just the kids, the atmosphere of the country is reflected in the classroom too. These kids, they have no discipline. It's such a struggle. But Frank, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Another question.
Yeah.
The former lawyer who you had on, what was his Arbery determination? What he thought was going on?
Just to be clear, he is a current lawyer, and if you ever kill someone, he's somebody whose number you want to have close by. But basically, what he said was the evidence would tend to support a conviction.
I'll tell you this, in my opinion, I think they're going to get off because it never was supposed to go this far because there was people in that judicial system who already buried it. And there was a romantic relationship, I think, between the shooter, the young gunman, and the woman. And so it was buried. It wasn't for the mother digging up, Reverend Al and Jesse to put this thing on the front burner. It's not going to go nowhere. But then the whole jury is almost all white. So I'm going to tell you, I think they're going to get away with it. And
we'll see. I don't think so. I think there will be a conviction there, Ron, but we'll see. Only time will tell. 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. Joe is in Ronkonkoma. Hello, Joe.
Hey, Joe. Hi, Frank. How are you?
Great. Great, Joe.
First, before we go, I want to wish you and your wife a very happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Very nice of you. You too.
I don't agree with the mandatory school thing with the Blasio's. I think what they should do, Frank, is I find with my two kids, the summer vacation is way too long. I think they should break it up and give them an extra week in the spring, maybe an extra week around Christmas. And if they give them those 2 months of where they're just stagnant, break it up and give them like 1 month when it's really, really hot and a lot of schools don't have air conditioning. I find my kids getting very, very, ornery. They're fighting with each other. They get into trouble. So I would see where it would be best if they would just spread it out versus giving them, 2 months straight where,
But, and that makes sense to me, Joe. But under your plan, under the Joe plan, would it add up to more school time, or would it be the same amount of school time that they are in now?
I think they need more school time. I think with COVID and everything that happened with the virtual learning, I think that's why the students are falling behind. But I think this was a plan by China to do this to other countries, because they're very intelligent over there in China. And we were up there. Now we have fallen. And I hear what you're saying. I can see that my kids, the rapid decline, we kept up with them during COVID with reading and stuff like that. But I think they should be more, give them maybe an extra week or two. But you got to also realize one other thing, Frank. The teacher unions, they're not going to.
Oh, I know. Oh, I'm aware of that. I'm absolutely aware of that. You're right about that.
Before I go.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I never received my hat.
You're kidding. Hey, Joe, can you email me so I could forward it to our new promotions person, and I'll make sure that we take that personally.
Yeah, sure, no problem.
Email
me
and I'll forward that now. Frank.Morano@WABCRadio.com. We've gone through a few promotions people of late, so it might have gotten lost in the cracks. But email me and I'll
no problem. It's getting cold out, so I want to support you. So,
thank you. Believe me, I appreciate that, Joe. Thank you. 800-848-WABC. Lenny is in Bethpage. Hello, Lenny.
Yes, hello, Frank.
Hey, Lenny.
How are you?
Good.
I just want to say, you're talking about school and education and how you rank around the world, right?
Right.
But if you take out the urban population in the United States, we'd rank at the top.
Well, that is true, but we don't grade school children based on race in the world. We grade it based on.
Think about it.
When we grade it based on country.
You can pass the Brussels, Stockholm, France. They don't have the same population we have. You take out our urban population, our suburban population, we'd be right at the top.
Well, that is a fair point, Lenny, and I think that underscores
a need. Point.
I think it underscores the need to explore what's going on in minority schools.
School choice would be perfect.
Well, look, I think what you're seeing at Eagle Academy with David Banks is doing, that's one of the reasons I'm so high on him. It goes to show that you can make significant gains in minority students if you put the work in. Eva Moskowitz has had similar success with the Success Academy school. 800-848-WABC. Ed is in New Jersey. Hello, Ed.
Hi, Frank. It's Ed the Milkman. My question is this. You know, everybody says more school time. Yeah, if you don't do well in a subject, they send it. You can't learn it in 9 months. How's the child going to learn it in 6 weeks in summer school? So I think that they have the problem is the curriculum is a one-size-fits-all, which it doesn't. When my son went to school, we fought every day to get him to school. And then they said, well, he's got an attention disorder. Problem. No, he doesn't. He just was bored with what you guys were doing. It was so repetitive. So I think that the whole curriculum really needs to be changed because, you know, certain kids are interested in certain things.
I would agree with that. What did you end up doing for your own son? How did you motivate him to get out of that rut that he was in?
He wouldn't. He's very good with his hands. We took him out of the regular school. We put him in a vocational school, which was okay. But he quit school. You can't force somebody to do something they don't want to. And they say, well, you know, he's very, very, he can't focus on anything. I said, this kid can go in the basement on a Saturday morning at 6 o'clock. And at 6 o'clock at night, you still can't get him to come upstairs and eat because he's busy taking the train apart, building the train set. And actually, where that led to was Lionel made a train that didn't work right, and he took it all apart and everything. And one day, the president of Lionel knocked on our door and wanted to speak to him. Yeah, and so, he ended up being the fellow that for, I think, 5 or 6 years, he put up that display in Grand Central Station.
Wow.
Lionel.
That's pretty neat. Well, and that underscores a point, Ed, and Curtis brought this up in his campaign. It underscores a point of the need for vocational schools and vocational training to be an option for a lot of young people that might not be a fit for college, for lack of a better term. I'm a big believer in increased vocational training when the opportunity presents itself. Rob is in Queens. Hello, Rob.
Hello, Frank. Good morning.
Morning.
I wanted to make a comment first about de Blasio with taxing the rich. I feel that if you tax the rich, all of us are going to be on welfare, at least majority of us. Second, in regards to education, if you want to leave, a lot of single parents, a lot of people in the city don't have the resources to have their kids in stuff during the summer, whether they're playing sports or in school. So if it's voluntary, I don't think it's terrible, but it's not. I think family time and making memories is more important. In regards to the decline of our education for kids, I don't feel that that's truly accurate. There's a lot of good kids out there, a lot of great teachers.
Absolutely.
But the education system needs help like anything else. Eric Adams has made statements already prior to being elected about the New York City school system being the most segregated system out there and one of the worst. And that he wants to change it. I don't know, in regards to busing kids to different schools that are doing bad. They have like this gifted and talented program where they would ask for volunteers when you're in an area where your kids are doing well to move them to another school where they're not doing as well, just to boost the numbers. And I don't agree with it. And you know, the part of living in the city is that you buy a home.
Right. Well,
that's an area where you we have a good school.
That's true. And it's interesting that you mentioned gifted and talented, Rob, because, again, this is one of the many de Blasio things that he's done that makes no sense. As de Blasio came out a month and a half ago and says he wants to do away with the gifted and talented program, whereas Curtis, Eric Adams says he doesn't want to do away with it. Curtis had said, not only do I not want to do away with it, I want to expand gifted and talented. And, you know, one of the ethnic groups that Curtis did best with was Asians. He won almost every Asian district in the city of New York. I mean, that's amazing for a Republican. And I think a big part of that is because of his adherence to gifted and talented and for his desire to preserve the specialized high school testing, which de Blasio has been out to lunch on both of those issues. And I think that could actually provide a political playbook. Again, I don't want to make this a political issue, but ultimately everything is. I think that could actually provide a political strategic playbook to Republicans running for office in New York City. How do you win assembly seats and council seats in New York City? Do you know how many Republican assembly members there are? Take a guess. Take a guess. There's two. There's two assembly members. Do you know how many assembly districts Curtis won when he ran for mayor? 15. 15. So those are 15 districts where it's possible for a Republican to win if they have the right candidates and the right messaging. And I think a big part of that messaging would include educational opportunities like expanding gifted and talented, like preserving the specialized high school admissions test. We're going to do $1,000 minute, but I want to squeeze in at least one more call here because it's a subject I'm interested in, and I'm far from an expert in it, and I enjoy learning from so many of you that are much better informed on it than I am. Ashley's on Long Island. Hello, Ashley.
Yeah, I think we're blaming the teachers too much. I think the blame is on the parents. I used to be a super years ago, and I tutored kids in the hallway. And every kid, without exception, moved up to be a B student or an A student. Why? When they come in to me, I ask them, what did the teacher say today? What did you do in school today? And they can't tell me. I open the business. Kids come in. What did you learn today? What did the teacher discuss today?
Mm-hmm.
Most of them don't. And believe me, the Indians and the Chinese, they go after their kids. The kids come home in the evening. What did you do in school today? And tell me what the teacher said today.
Well, and it's interesting that you mention that because we've seen immigrants from those schools, from those countries, even though they might be poor, their children tend to outperform not only minority students, but white students, even white students that are from better socioeconomic backgrounds. So I think there might be something to what you're saying. I think there is a cultural aspect to this. There's a reason poor Indian and poor Asian students can come here as immigrants and do better than white students whose families have been in the country for 100 years. I think there's something to what you said there. Hey, we're going to do the $1,000 minute. Those of you that are holding and want to comment on this, continue to hold and we'll get to you. But we're going to give one of you an opportunity to win $1,000. If you want to win $1,000, be the seventh caller to 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. And we will ask you 10 trivia questions in 60 seconds. And you'll win, if you can answer those 10 questions in 60 seconds, $1,000. Dial now, 800-848-9222. For those of you who don't win $1,000, there is a way that you can enjoy long-term financial security. That is with gold, silver, and precious metals. The national debt is out of control. Inflation is out of control. And gold and silver offer a hedge against inflation. Gold and silver increase in value the less the dollar is worth. So if you have your money in a traditional retirement account, think about rolling it into a gold or a silver IRA. And if you do it, you should think about doing it with Legacy Precious Metals, because these guys are experts. They give you unbiased information based on your individual situation. Legacy Precious Metals. Give them a call today. Write this number down. 866-932-0635. That's 866-932-0635. You know, they used to say all that glitters is not gold. That is, of course, true. But all gold does glitter. And if you want to see it glitter in your portfolio, go to the website legacypminvestments.com. You can request some information for free. And when they ask you where you heard about it, tell them you heard about it from me. Frank Morano, $1,000 Minute. Next.
Start your morning with Frank Morano on 77 WABC.
So who is this, Matt? This is Seal? Seal?
Seal Crazy.
This is the same guy that used to go out with Heidi Klum?
That is correct. Married to Heidi Klum.
This is weird. I'm not crazy about this. I liked his song, Kiss from a Rose. You know, you're going to talk crazy. There's, I like Gnarls Barkley's version of Crazy. And then there was a Patsy Cline version, Patsy Cline and the Jordanaires version of Crazy. This is not just crazy. It doesn't sound crazy. It doesn't sound like a crazy song. But, you know, we like to experiment. Maybe we're winning over some Seal fans out there. Who knows? All right. Time now for one lucky listener to have an opportunity to answer 10 questions correctly and win $1,000 as part of
The Other Side of Midnight presents
It's the $1,000 Minute. Answer 10 questions correctly in 1 minute, and you could win $1,000. Here's your host, Frank Morano.
Yes, thank you, Chris Libertini. Let's meet today's contestant, Mike in the Bronx. Hey there, Mike. Good morning.
Good morning. I feel like Ralph Cramden on the $99,000 answer.
Well, hopefully things turn out better for you than they did for him.
Hemina. Yes, I do.
No, don't be nervous, because yesterday a caller, the contestant lost on what was a pretty easy question, and the consensus among the Facebook group was he only lost because he was nervous. So I know you got to go through these questions quickly, which can be a little anxiety-inducing, but try to think for a half a second. You're going to have time, and you're either going to know these questions or you're not. Think for a half a second and then answer. All right, Mike?
Gotcha.
Okay, so we're going to start the timer as soon as after I ask the first question. If you get a question right, we're just going to move on to the next question so that we can get through all these. If you get a question wrong, you'll hear an incorrect buzzer. Ready to go, Mike?
Ready.
All right. How many boroughs are in New York City?
5.
What shape has 3 sides and 3 corners?
3 sides and 3 corners. A triangle.
Who sang the song Born in the USA?
Bruce Springsteen.
What president did both Rudy Giuliani and Mark Levin work in the administration of?
Ronald Reagan.
Who was the only president to serve 2 non-consecutive terms?
William Howard Taft.
Unfortunately, that is incorrect. That was actually Grover Cleveland, Mike. William Howard Taft had an interesting history. He was president, and then he was defeated for re-election by Woodrow Wilson, and then he got appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and he finished his days on the U.S. Supreme Court. But a good guess, though, a good guess. Mike, if you hang on the line, Philip will take your information, and we will send you a complimentary WABC cap. Philip looks a little nervous, actually. But Philip, grab Mike's information, and we'll send him a consolation prize. If you want to purchase a hat, you can do so. WABCRadioStore.com. That's WABCRadioStore.com. Speaking of all things WABC, why not have a look at the WABC clip of the day? This clip comes to us from the Bo Snerdly show, and this is from James Golden.
In New York, the protesters actually went in and stole American flags. Now, can you get more patriotic than that? Here you are with these losers, these miscreants, these rioters on the West Coast stealing Louis Vuitton bags. What are they going to do? Wave Louis Vuitton bags on their flagpoles? No.
That's actually very funny. That is very funny. I had not heard him say that. You could catch James Golden every afternoon at 4 p.m., although today I think he might be off. He might be off this whole week. I think he's off today. I believe Lydia Serrani is filling in, or either Lydia or Dominic Carter will be filling in. But he's on generally every day at 4 p.m. Now, let me read one or two more quick emails, and then we will continue with your phone calls. This is an email from John Ross. Hello, Frank. My name is John Ross. I listen every night, and I wanted to say that your show is a breath of fresh air. Your show, like Seinfeld, is a, quote, show about nothing. Yet you discuss and cover everything in such a thought-provoking and intriguing manner. This is the highest compliment that I can pay you because of your brilliance and engaging format that you provide your, for your audience, which I am proud and privileged to be a part of. I can't thank you enough for all the information and knowledge that you share with us. I've learned so much and really appreciate the different views that you provide. God bless you, and please keep up the amazing work. Forever a fan, John Ross. That was awfully nice. Very, very, very nice. Now, some emails here that aren't as nice. This is from David Ball. Frank, today's guest, Daphne Barak, she was the one that interviewed Ghislaine Maxwell from prison. While conducting her interview concerning Ghislaine Maxwell, who faces the rest of her life behind bars if convicted of abusing and procuring young girls, stated that she wished all parties involved a happy ending, quote. Inappropriate? What say you? Look, Daphne is from Israel. I think that was just part of, I think that was just maybe a poor choice of words on her part. I wouldn't read too much into that. John, there's another call named John from Holmdale. Frank, that was the best show I have heard. The 9 minutes from 94 minutes in to 103 minutes in, the couch and cat story laughed my tuchus off. Thank you and keep it up. Oh, this is a very relevant email here. This is from Anna Maria. Morning. Sorry, but I have to comment on the $1,000 game. How would anyone know who the council speaker is or Corey Johnson if you don't know New York politics? Do you know who the council president for the city of Paterson, New Jersey is? I would not expect you to. It seems a tad unfair that the questions go from 12 inches in a foot to council speaker after three questions. Point is, if it is a question about our country, president's name, wife's name, vice president's name, etc., okay, I know you get the idea. I personally think it's unfair and really not very nice to ask questions about New York politics, especially if a person does not live in New York. Maybe politics should be left out of the game to be fair to all callers. Maybe, I don't agree. Look, we're not going to change the questions based on. We're going to change the questions based on who's calling in. Questions are the questions. So I don't think so. This is an email from Jim. Good morning, Frank. Enjoy your show very much. I particularly like hearing about your involvement in the production, etc., of other shows. However, there is one thing bothering me, sort of a pet peeve. The announcer pronounces your name as if he's saying Morano instead of Morano, as if the A in your name is an O. Maybe not a big thing to some, but everyone should expect to have their name pronounced as accurately as possible. It's a respect thing for old-timer Italians like me. It's from Jim. So, you know, I tend to say Morano just because my dad and I think my mother both say Morano. But I think Morano is also correct. If you look at the pronunciation of Nissan Murano, it's M-U-R-A-N-O. If you look at the island of Murano, where they make Murano glass, they pronounce it that way. In the Italian alphabet, you know, when you study Italian in school, you sing the alphabet and the words are sung as they're pronounced. So the alphabet always begins A, B, C, D, and it's helpful because you know when you see a C, it's pronounced as a ch, ch, chi. When you see an A in the Italian alphabet, it's pronounced as an A, A. So I think if you go by the Italian pronunciation, it is actually Morano, not Morano. But as the old expression goes, call me Morano, as long as you don't call me late for happy hour, I will be one happy camper. All right, I want to squeeze in a couple of more quick calls here before we get to 15 seconds of fame. Let me say hello to Helen in Connecticut. Hello, Helen.
Hello there. Almost anything that de Blasio is in favor of, I'm in disfavor of. The man has great hubris, and what he's proposing is merely a campaign thing. I totally agreed with Curtis because I taught in the gifted and talented programs for years in the public school system. And one of the key things here is the parents and our society. And the gentleman that called before who brought that up, I thought was very, very interesting because it's extremely relevant. We have way too much. Are you there, Frank?
Yes, I'm listening to you.
Oh, good. Oh, wow. This is amazing. That's one of your skills. You actually listen. So one of the most important things in terms of education and what's happening in the United States is we have too much entertainment. We have too much time away from what is relevant for our children. And our society, unfortunately, does not support the kind of education and excellence that a lot of parents that this gentleman and you discussed, which is a lot of immigrants who come here, want to pay attention to what their children are doing. And that's why a lot of those children succeed, not because they have advantages economically. Mm-hmm. That is not what it's about. It's about paying attention, turning off the darn media stuff, and dealing with what your children are learning and your participation in what's happening there. And we don't have a lot of that in the United States. We're extremely on the opposite end of that spectrum. And when I taught in the gifted and talented programs, I had a lot of children who were extremely intelligent, and I had some children who were intelligent. We didn't go by testing in the district that I was working in. It wasn't the ASTER program as it was designed with regard to IQ testing, which is not always the indication that a child is going to excel. But the children were highly intelligent. But the participation of the parents, the kind of home environments that were there, were extremely supportive of what was happening. It was a synergy between the home and the parents.
Well, that's how it should be, Helen, and that's how I hope it is with my child. And it sounds like you were a pretty great teacher, so your students were awfully lucky. We're just about out of time. We're going to do 15 seconds of fame next. If you want to comment on anything, including schooling, for 15 seconds, now's the time. 800-848-9222. We have 1, 2, 3 open lines. 1-800-848-WABC. So you could start queuing up. Meantime, is there anything that feels better when your bowels are all stopped up and you're feeling clogged and logy and you can't move like you are after watching the Dallas Cowboys on Thanksgiving? Is there anything that feels better than getting a little relief, than having those bowels cleared? No. That's where Life Change Tea comes in. Life Change Tea is a phenomenal product. It is a gentle daily cleanse that tastes great and works to get things moving. Stress can wreak havoc on our digestive tract. Life Change Tea can help. One package will last you a whole month. It is only available by logging on to the website getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. And you can use the promo code Frank. Use the promo code Frank, and you will get to enjoy free shipping anywhere in these United States. GetTheTea.com, promo code Frank. Not only will you get free shipping on the tea, but they sell all sorts of other supplements on there. You'll get free shipping on that as well. GetTheTea.com, promo code Frank. This is The Other Side of Midnight. This is a great song from Andy B, who, when Gabby Lopez was here yesterday, she identified Andy B as the caller that she missed the most. So that's a very, very, it's quite an auspicious distinction. All right, now's your time to call in and be heard on any subject for 15 seconds, because it's time for
Other Side of Midnight. This is 15 Seconds of Fame.
The Cheech from Howard Beach. Hello.
Good morning, Frank. Let's get this out of the way. Go, Buchanan, go. Go, Buchanan, go. We want the Floridoris. We want the Floridoris. Take the moron. Take the moron. Did I leave anything out?
There's actually one guy who acts like he's Stonewall Jackson. You left him out. And another guy who quotes something biblical. 800-848-9222. Mike is in the Bronx. Hello.
Hello. Schools should be for learning, not indoctrination.
800-848-9222. Jeff is in Suffern County.
Frank, Bill de Blasio shouldn't be getting any airtime. He's done. He's has been. He's never will be. And the kids got to learn from their peers in the neighborhood. School's important, but guys in the neighborhood to teach you how to live your life.
Hindi is in Somerset. Hello.
Can't wait to see Eric Adams' inauguration. I'm going to bet Lewis and Al have front row center seats.
Ted is in Forest Hills.
The Beatles played in the Soviet Union. There's no interstellar travel, and the Farragut Falcon is the fastest of all animals.
Mark is in Newark.
Thank you, Frank, for what you said in the beginning about Saudi Arabia. Thank you.
You're welcome. Rogers in Massachusetts. Hello.
Yeah, I think the I agree with the year-round, number one, with a 1 week off every season. The woman that called it from Connecticut a minute ago, I agree 100% with what she said. And when Dominic visited Japan, they are in school on Saturdays.
800-848-WABC. Raji is in New York City.
On WABC, there's a Howard Stern wannabe who is so bereft of ideas and obsessed with octogenarians that he urges them to get on a show and to moan and groan to fake climaxing on the radio.
Well, Raji, that might be the best commercial that show has ever had. All right, that about slams the lid on things for this morning. But you're going to want to stay tuned to the WABC Early News. We've got a ton of news coming your way for the next hour. We've got Thomas Jefferson news. We've got Roger Stone news. We've got Wisconsin news. We've got Rittenhouse news. We have more news than you can shake a stick at, and it's all coming up turn the radio up, because you are about to be informed with Juliet Huddy and me. We're going to tell you exactly what's worth hearing about. This has been a lot of fun. You want to stay in touch with me, you can email me, frank.morano@wabcradio.com, or you can find me on Twitter at Frank, M-O-R-A-N-O. That's Frank, M-O-R-A-N-O.